I got it right here.
Good morning. We're going to go ahead and open up this interim committee on judiciary.
House interim committee on judiciary is open.
And it's water.
I know.
Yes.
Grey goose.
Okay, so we're having informational meetings today. We're going to start off with a large presentation on the eyewitness identification presentation. We have invited testimony. In our introduction, we're going to have three individuals, Gil Meyer, Jason Myers, and Kevin Campbell. But Bill, do you want to kind of give us a preview?
Sure. Mr. Chair, as members of the committee, on about last December, I read an article in the New York Times about a New Jersey case on eyewitness identification. 160-page opinion. You'll hear about it today. And then I talked to Gail Myers, I talked to Sheriff Myers, and you'll see a presentation from 60 Minutes here. And they give a test during this presentation. And I looked at that. I have been in a situation where I've had to attempt to identify someone who pointed a gun at me and demanded my wallet many years ago. And I've done criminal defense work, and I've represented a police department. And we all know that one of the most fundamental aspects of criminal justice is eyewitness identification. And what the research now shows and what you'll see today, if not done right, it can be highly inaccurate. And I think this is fundamental to our criminal justice system. Central justice is accuracy and eyewitness identification. What I was impressed with is the fact that everyone in the criminal justice system is now aware of the issue. When I talked to Sheriff Myers about this in the state police, when we were working another issue, they are aware of the issue. They are in the process through training of correcting the issue. If done right, done appropriately, eyewitness identification can be a lot more accurate than if done inappropriately. And that's what you'll hear today. For one housekeeping measure, for those of you who are members of the Oregon State Bar, we have a sign-up sheet over there. And this program will apply for COA credit. And in the past, we've got COA credit. So you'll have an opportunity to listen to the presentation and get free COA. So I know I'm going to sign up. So I think you're going to hear an excellent presentation. I think you're going to hear one that's based not only just in law, but on science.
All right. Any questions for Bill? Why don't we start with our first panel, Gil, Kevin, and Jason, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chairs, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Thank you for your attention this morning on this issue of eyewitness identification. I'd like to underscore what Bill Taylor was just saying. This issue has grabbed the attention of everyone in the criminal justice system. The courts are grappling with it, law enforcement is, the defense community is, prosecutors are, and the science has gone way in front of the law at this point, and the rest of us are trying to catch up now with the science. The good news for Oregon is that many other states have convened task forces where they've called to the table the best and the brightest and the experts in this field. Many of those states have published tomes of task force reports with appendices. And the good news is we can be the beneficiaries of all their work, and we really don't need to replicate it. And so I've been reading it, sharing it, and others have been reading it as well. During the interim, I sat down with Kevin Campbell, and I talked to him, and I said, you know, I think that we can do better here in Oregon. There really isn't any codified law in this state that has anything really to do statutorily with the way in which eyewitness identification protocols are administered. And I'm certainly not interested in legislating law enforcement work, but one key reform that is identified in all those task force reports is, number one, the importance of embracing evidence-based practices and training and written protocols and standards so that each law enforcement agency has something in writing that guides the agents and officers as they're engaging in this identification procedures in the field. So I've been talking with law enforcement during the interim. This is a more collaborative approach than not. and we hope to be coordinated and on the same page in 2013.
Thank you, chairs and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I want to thank Gail because we have an opportunity to really work through this in a way that I think all of you support, which is collaboration and not fighting in the legislature where you have to decide between two foes. We are working together largely on this. I want to begin just by saying what you already know, which is that wrongful convictions is an unacceptable outcome of the criminal justice system. So we're all agreed, Gail and the rest of the public safety profession, regarding that as an unacceptable result of the system. In Oregon, we're fortunate because we have good working relationships at all levels of law enforcement. So state, county, and city law enforcement leaders did not have any trouble getting together to work on this issue collaboratively in order to create a policy that recognizes the difficulties involved in these cases, how intricate they can be, along with the differences in size of agencies and how that impacts the way cases move forward, in order to work on a policy. And so later on in this hearing, you'll hear from members of a work group that have been working for a number of months to try to create that policy, and I can tell you they've been working hard at it. Later today, you'll hear from Chief John Teague. He's the chief of police for the city of Dallas, and he's been the chair of the work group effort. He was already at work on eyewitness policy identification policy for his own agency and was in the process of refining that himself when we put together the work group. You'll also hear from Lieutenant Rob Anderson. He is the person at the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training who does this training for all new police officers going through the Basic Academy and has recently or is in the process of completing his master's thesis on the issue of eyewitness ID. So we were fortunate to have someone in state that's actually been doing quite a bit of work on this issue. You'll hear from Joe Simon. Joe is the director of the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. This is probably one of the more important organizations in our state because what it does is it challenges police agencies to not just adopt policies on critical law enforcement issues, but to have them operational throughout their departments. The kind of policy that could be tested and officers would be able to cite it and would be actually utilizing the policy. So it's not just a dead policy manual on a table anymore. We're encouraging agencies to really move forward and be accredited. And then Rod Underhill from the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office will talk about it from a prosecutor's perspective, because in the end, the cases they end up with are either good or poor. An eyewitness ID, as you will find, it cannot be the basis for a case. It can be a piece, but not the basis. And so in Oregon, I think we've worked hard to make sure that it's in its proper perspective. I want to thank the committee for giving us a chance to work on this issue. Thank you for the day today to present. I think it'll be a very interesting next hour or two. So thank you very much.
Morning, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Jason Myers. I'm the Marion County Sheriff, and it's a pleasure to be here today. I wanted to take just a couple of minutes and speak as an executive of a law enforcement agency and as a former investigator. I can tell you that eyewitness IDs are an important part of any criminal investigation. However, this is only one piece of an investigation. The law enforcement profession in our state has always tended to be more progressive than in other parts of our country. This progression can be seen in the great work that the men and women do in our communities and through the thorough criminal investigations that they conduct around our state each and every day. Our law enforcement officers are taught that investigations containing eyewitness IDs must have additional evidence. Witness statements or circumstantial information in order to prosecute the case. Simply stated, eyewitness IDs must be supported by additional evidence. Eyewitness ID is an evolving science, and Oregon law enforcement is ready to embrace the best practices around this science. As Mr. Campbell has indicated and Ms. Meyer, a work group of sheriffs, chiefs, prosecutors, folks from the accreditation area have been meeting to develop a model policy for law enforcement around our state. Once this policy is completed, it will be adopted by the Sheriffs and Chiefs Association and law enforcement agencies around the state. A final note I'd like to talk about is training is a critical component of eyewitness ID as well as all of the other issues facing our law enforcement officers. It's important that we maintain this foundational training for both leadership and line officers. And this training, this foundational training, is comes through our Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I'd like to thank all of you for giving us this opportunity today, and would be happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right. I doubt there's any questions right now. Is there? Well, why don't we go ahead and start with the presentation.
Thank you.
First thing is going to be our 60-minute video from the show 60 Minutes. And is this the one that's going to have the test at the end, Bill?
Yes. When I went listened to it, I took the test and flunked it, frankly.
We already failed.
Yeah.
Okay. Moment when the eyewitness is asked, "Do you see the person?" It's a cliche of courtroom dramas. That moment when the eyewitness is asked, "Do you see the person who committed the crime here in this courtroom before you?" Well, it happens in real courtrooms all the time. And to jurors, that point of the finger by a confident witness is about as damning as evidence can get. But there is one type of evidence that's even more persuasive, and that, of course, is DNA. There have been more than 235 people exonerated by DNA in this country. And as we first reported in March, now a stunning pattern has emerged. More than three-quarters of them were sent to prison, at least in part, because an eyewitness pointed a finger. An eyewitness who we now know was wrong. It was hot and humid in Burlington, North Carolina, on the night of July 28, 1984. Jennifer Thompson, then a 22-year-old college student, had gone to bed early in her off-campus apartment. As she slept, a man shattered the light bulb near her back door, cut her phone line, and broke in.
I remember kind of waking up and turning my head to the side and saying, "Who's there? Who is it?" And I saw the top of someone's head kind of sliding beside my mattress. And I screamed, and I felt blade go to my throat. "A knife? A knife." And he told me to shut up or he was going to kill me.
Her first thought was to offer him anything she had to go away.
"You can have my credit card, you can have my wallet, you can have anything in the apartment, you can have my car." And he looked at me and said, "I don't want your money." And I knew what was getting ready to happen.
She vowed to stay alert and study him so that if she lived, she could help put him away forever.
"What is his voice? Does he have an accent? Does he have a scar? Is there a tattoo?"
"He's raping you and you're studying his face."
It was just trying to pay attention to a detail that if I survived, and that was my plan, I'd be able to help the police catch him.
After about half an hour, Jennifer tricked the rapist into letting her get up and fix him a drink, and she ran out the back door. He fled and raped a second woman half a mile away. Detective Mike Galden met Jennifer at the hospital.
"The first comment I remember her making was that, 'I'm going to get this guy that did this to me.' She said, 'I took the time to look at him. I will be able to identify him if I'm given an opportunity.'"
Detective Galden worked with Jennifer to make a composite sketch, poring over eyes, noses, ears, lips, trying to recreate the face she had seen that night. The sketch went out and tips started coming in. One of those tips was about a young man named Ronald Cotton, who worked at a restaurant near the scene of both rapes and had a record a guilty plea to breaking and entering, and as a teenager, to sexual assault. 3 days after the rape, Mike Alden called Jennifer in to do a photo lineup. He laid these 6 pictures down on the table, said the perpetrator may or may not be one of them, and told her to take her time.
I can remember almost feeling like I was at a PCT test. You know, we start narrowing down your choices. You can discount A and B. And
oh, like multiple choice.
Exactly.
According to the police report, Jennifer studied the pictures for 5 minutes.
She picked up Ron's photograph and said, that's the man right there.
And you must have studied, sure. And she said, yes.
Oh, yes. Certainly.
Ronald Cotton heard the news from his mother's boyfriend.
He told me, Ron, he said, police are looking for you. And I said, for what? He told me, for rape. I said, man, I didn't commit such a crime like that.
Did you panic?
I did panic. I'm trying to figure out, you know, why.
He comes in and gives me a very detailed account of where he was, who he was with that night. As it turns out, that was a false alibi.
I realized later that I had got my weekends confused, and so therefore, I gave them the reason to think that I was lying.
This was August 1st, 1984.
Right.
You go in to clear yourself. When did you actually leave?
I didn't.
He was locked up and days later put in a physical lineup.
I'm number 5.
You scared?
I was very scared, nervous. I was so nervous. I was trembling. You know, I felt my body just shaking.
They were asked to step forward, speak, and step back.
I can remember looking to the detective and saying, it's between 4 and 5. Can I have him do it again?
And then she knew it was number 5, Ronald Cotton.
Did you feel absolutely certain?
Absolutely certain.
Did anybody say to you, good job?
Well, what was said to me afterwards was, that's the same person you picked out in the photo lineup. So in my mind, I thought, bingo, I did it right. I did it right. In a week-long trial, the jury heard about Ronald Cotton's faulty alibi, his clothing that matched Jennifer's description, and a piece of foam found on her floor that seemed to come from one of his shoes. And most powerfully, they heard from Jennifer.
When they ask you, do you recognize the man who did this to you? Did you point to him?
It was Ronald Cotton.
She called me a former friend. That's all it takes, it seemed like.
What did that feel like?
It felt like someone pushed my knife through me.
It took the jury just 40 minutes. The verdict, guilty on all counts.
He was sentenced to life in 50 years. And it was for me that moment that you know the justice system works. Because I am the victim, and he's a horrible person, and he will never, ever be free again.
Ronald Cotton was handcuffed, shackled, and taken to North Carolina's Central Prison. He was 22 years old.
You know, they say grown men don't cry, but it's a lot, you know. I grabbed my pillow many times and hugged it. I was hurting my mom, my dad, sister, brother. I hope she didn't have to be this way.
He started working in the prison kitchen, singing in the choir, and writing letter after letter to his attorneys, hoping to get a new trial. Then one day, as he watched a new inmate being brought in, he had a strange feeling.
I said, excuse me. I said, you look for me. I said, where are you from? He said, I'm from Belton. I said, I am too. I said, you kind of resemble the drawing of a suspect in a crime of which I'm falsely proven. Well, did you commit this crime? And he told me, no, he did not.
Wait a sec. You saw him and thought of that composite drawing?
Mm-hmm.
His name was Bobby Poole, and he was in for rape. He started working in the prison kitchen, too.
The stewardess were calling me Poole instead of Cotton.
They were calling you by his name?
Yes.
In other words, people were mistaking the two of you.
Yes, exactly.
Then a fellow inmate told him that he'd heard Bobby Poole admit to raping Jennifer and the other woman that night. Ronald Cotton won a new trial, and his lawyers called Bobby Poole to the stand with Jennifer sitting right there. It was the moment Ronald Cotton had been hoping for.
Bobby Poole is in the courtroom. You look over there. What happens inside you?
Nothing.
Nothing?
Nothing.
As a matter of fact, the strongest emotion I felt was anger at the defense. Because I thought, how dare you? How dare you question me? How dare you try to paint me as someone who could possibly have forgotten what my rapist looked like? I mean, the one person you would never forget. How dare you?
Ronald Cotton was convicted again, this time given 2 life sentences. Back in prison, 7 years later, he and everyone else was riveted by a big news story, the trial of O.J. Simpson.
I would get my radio, put my earplugs, and go outside, sit in a corner.
And listen to the trial.
Yeah.
He was intrigued by something he had never... heard of, DNA. He wrote to his new attorney, law professor Rich Rosen. Rosen warned him that there probably wasn't any evidence left to test, and if there was, DNA could cut both ways.
Understand, if the DNA comes back and shows that you did this crime, whatever legal issues we have don't make any bit of difference. You're going to spend the rest of your life in prison.
He warned you
mm-hmm.
that if it comes up positive, you're sunk.
Tell him to put his foot down and go with it.
Packed away on the shelves of the Burlington Police Department was 10-year-old evidence from the 2 rapes that night. Inside one of the rape kits was a fragment of a single sperm with viable DNA. It proved what Ronald Cotton had been saying all along. He was innocent, and the rapist was Bobby Poole. Within days, Ronald Cotton was back in court.
You're walking out here today as a free man.
This time, to be released.
So, not only do you find out that Ron didn't do the crime, you find out Bobby Poole did.
It was just utter shock, really. Disbelief. I mean, by this time, this is 11 years later. And, you know, I know that I've been involved in a case where the man's lost 11 years of his life. And I was so sad for him and his family.
In the years since Ronald Cotton's conviction, Jennifer had married and had children.
Are you the one that tells her?
Yes. Her reaction was, no, that can't be true. It's not possible. You know, I know Ronald Cotton raped me. The question in my mind.
It was like someone had just taken my life and like turned it upside down. She cried?
Oh, she cried. She broke down. I mean, she took it all on herself. You know, the guilt. You know, I did this to that man.
But when she thought or dreamed about that night, it was still Ronald Cotton's face she saw. To get past it, she asked if he would meet with her at a local church.
I remember him walking into the church, and I physically could not stand up.
She was nervous, scared.
I started to cry immediately, and I looked at him, and I said, Ron, if I spent every second of every minute, every hour of the rest of my life telling you how sorry I am, it wouldn't come close to how my heart feels. I'm so sorry. And Ronald just leaned down. He took my hands.
Oh, gosh.
And he looked at me and he said, I forgive you.
I told her, I forgive you. I want you to look over your shoulder. And I just want us to be happy and move on in life.
The minute he forgave me, it's like my heart physically started to heal. And I thought, this is what grace and mercy is all about. This is what they teach you in church that none of us ever get. And here is this man that I had hated. I used to pray every day of my life during those 11 years that he would die. That he would be raped in prison and someone would kill him in prison. That was my prayer to God. And here was this man who, with grace and mercy, just forgave me. That is overwhelming. It's overwhelming how wrong I was and how good he is.
How is it that Jennifer could have studied her rapist so carefully and still made this mistake? And how could she have failed to recognize Bobby Poole, the actual rapist, when he sat right in front of her in the courtroom 3 years later. That part of the story when we come back.
I think I did say it.
So our next presentation is James Bronson. No?
The presenters would like to flip the order and have Professor Dan Riesberg go first.
That's fine.
Yeah.
Just
thank you.
Working off our schedule here.
Thank you.
All I have from the update.
Mr. Chair, if I could, there is another tape to this. The second part of the tape does give you the test. And what we can do is we can forward to all of you both of the sites on that. So.
Okay. So we're off the hook on the test today, huh?
Yes.
Thank goodness.
Yeah. And there's nobody else, huh? The pleasures of high tech. Chair Pruszynski, co-chair Barker and Krieger, members of both committees. My name is Daniel Riesberg. I'm psychology professor at Reed College in Portland. And I'd like to begin this morning, if I may, with some quick follow-up on the video you just saw. Ronald Cotton's story is tragic. He lost 11 years of his life for a crime he did not commit. But let's not lose track of the fact that with Ronald in jail, the real perpetrator, Bobby Poole, as you just heard, continued to walk around free for many months. And Bobby Poole raped again and again before he was eventually caught. In other words, by falsely convicting Cotton, we left Poole out on the streets. Now, convicting the innocent is obviously a horrible error, and we must find ways to avoid that error. There's a fundamental issue of justice there. But let's not lose track of the fact that there's also a public safety issue here, because bad IDs let guilty people go free. Convicting Cotton, who was innocent, left Poole, who was guilty, on the loose. But how widespread are these problems? Ronald Cotton was, as you heard, exonerated through DNA evidence, and as the video mentioned, there are now almost 300 DNA exonerations in the United States. These are cases in which DNA evidence available only after the trial made it clear that we put the wrong guy in jail. And in fact, there is a massively consistent pattern to those exonerations. Again, as you heard in the video, roughly three-quarters of those wrongful convictions can be traced to a single problem, namely mistaken IDs, just like Jennifer Thompson's. Put differently, bad IDs account for more of those wrongful convictions than all other causes combined. However, there has been some debate about those exonerations. Many people suggest that these 300 cases are just the tip of a very large iceberg, and the real number of mistaken convictions they suggest is much larger. But I want to emphasize that other people have challenged this idea. Among other points, they urge us to compare these 300 or so exonerations to the roughly 24 million convictions in the U.S. over the same time period. Of course, each of those 300 exonerations is tragic, but they're just a tiny percentage of the whole, so maybe we're getting alarmed here about a rare problem. In addition, some people point with pride and maybe with a little bit of relief to the fact that there have been zero exonerations in Oregon. There have been several in California, three in Washington State, one in Idaho just to the east of us, but so far we've had none. So maybe we're okay. Well, I have my own views on those points, but happily, I think we can step away from these complexities, and I want us instead to look at less extreme cases. Cases in which there was a mistaken ID, but it didn't go all the way to a mistaken conviction. Those cases are actually far more numerous, and therefore I think give us a much fuller and, I would say, a much better portrait of what happens in actual police investigations. And as you'll see in a second, those cases point to the same conclusion as the DNA exonerations, namely that we do need to worry about the prospect of eyewitness errors. Specifically, researchers have, in a number of jurisdictions, gained access to police records and analyzed how IDs in that jurisdiction unfold. Now, here we're not looking at a tiny sample of the cases overall, because the researchers examine all of the cases in that jurisdiction within a certain time span so that we get a much more complete, much more accurate sense of how these IDs go. For example, Bierman and Davey examined 300 cases from the police files in Sacramento, and they asked in these real IDs how often the witnesses choose from a lineup one of the fillers, someone included in the lineup, just to make sure the lineup has the right number of guys in it. They found that 24% of the selections were of these fillers, witnesses choosing someone who we know to be entirely innocent. Here's a different study from a different jurisdiction, and another one, this time from England. Wright and McDade surveyed over 1,000 ID attempts, and their data, 20% of the witnesses chose one of the fillers, again, someone innocent. And in case you haven't gotten the point by now, here's yet another study. Obviously, we have a mountain of data to work with here, and these are, of course, real IDs in real police investigations. And the data are, I think, stunningly consistent. Plainly, therefore, witnesses do make a lot of mistakes, and that by itself should be ringing some alarm bells for us. But we might, in addition, also ask, how consequential are these errors? After all, the police know, of course, who the suspect is in the lineup and who the fillers are. So if a witness chooses a filler, the police know immediately that the witness has made a mistake, and they're not going to take that ID seriously and scoot the filler off to jail. You might think, therefore, that this is a case of no harm, no foul. We tried to get an ID. We didn't get one. End of story. But that's wrong. Once the witness has chosen the filler, we can't go back to that witness and say, sorry, you were wrong, try again. That's leading the witness, that's coaching, and any defense attorney would have a great time with it. As a result, once a witness has made a bad choice, we can't use that witness again for an ID. As the police say, we have burned that witness. And so every time a witness makes a bad ID, we lose evidence. We undercut our own investigations. We interfere with our efforts toward prosecuting criminals. Once again, therefore, but now for a very different reason, bad IDs let guilty people go free. I think then it's pretty clear we do have a problem here. ID errors happen a lot. 1 in 5 is a good estimate, and those errors cost us. But we also have at least a partial solution. For more than 100 years, scientists have been studying how people perceive the world around them and then how they remember what they've perceived. And for the last 25 years or so, a lot of this research has focused on precisely the types of memory that are directly relevant to police investigations. And so we now have a wealth of secure, carefully established science that we can draw on in hopes of improving the system. Of course, as a member of the scientific community, I'm very proud of this research. But let's also be clear that many people outside of the research community are also seeing the value in this work. That's reflected in the growing number of states and a growing number of law enforcement agencies who are working in partnership with the scientists to develop new policies and new practices. We've provided you this morning as part of the materials with one illustration, the guidelines coming out of Rhode Island. Let me emphasize that I do not want to endorse 100% of what's in the Rhode Island guidelines. I do have some reservations about a couple of the things they're doing, but I want to offer it as one example of many, making it clear that there is indeed, as Gail mentioned before, a nationwide movement toward improving ID procedures by relying on the available research. So,
What can the research tell us? The answer, in truth, is very lengthy because we do know a lot, and there's no way I could cover all of it this morning. Instead, what I thought I would do is zoom in on just two broad illustrations in order to let you see what's on offer here, and I want to focus specifically on things that we can actually change, things that we can improve. And the first example I want to discuss focuses on the instructions that we give to an eyewitness before conducting a lineup. Now, just as a quick preliminary, many of you may not realize that when law enforcement professionals, or for that matter, when I use the term lineup, we are almost always referring to a sheet of paper containing six photos. On TV, you still see live lineups in which the six guys shuffle in and the witness is sitting behind a one-way mirror. In Oregon, and indeed around the world, that procedure is now extremely rare. It's far more common to do what's called a photo lineup, showing the suspect and pictures of five fillers. There are actually a number of advantages to this procedure, and we can talk about that later if you like. But please understand that when I talk about a lineup, I do mean a photo lineup, or as it's sometimes called, a photo montage. But in any case, sensibly, appropriately, most witnesses have full confidence in the police, and of course they should. And so if the police bring you a lineup, you're likely to assume that the police know what they're doing and that the actual perpetrator is included in the lineup. Your job, therefore, is to choose him. And if you can't make a choice, you might think that's going to reflect badly on you, suggesting perhaps that you have a lousy memory or that you're not cooperating. And if you can't make a choice, you might think that that's going to stall the investigation and perhaps allow the criminal to get away. Now, no one encourages these ideas in the witness, but we don't have to. These are the ideas that witnesses start with on their own. And these ideas are fine if this time around the police are chasing after the right suspect. In that case, the perpetrator is in the lineup, and we do hope that you'll select him. But what if, just by chance, this time the police are chasing after the wrong guy? That certainly can happen, and in that situation, if you make a selection, you are necessarily choosing someone innocent, and that's obviously a problem. For that matter, what if the perpetrator is in the lineup, but for some reason you don't remember it? Perhaps the crime was a month ago, or perhaps the lighting was bad the night of the crime. In those ways, you might legitimately not have a memory, and if you still feel obligated to make a choice, you're likely to make a random choice, and therefore a bad choice. So what do we do about this? I think the answer is pretty obvious. We need to tell the witness before the lineup that the perpetrator may or may not be shown in the lineup. We tell the witness it's okay to say, I don't see him there. We tell the witness the investigation will continue even if you don't make a selection. All right. I hope these ideas seem plausible to you, but as a scientist, my view is that plausible isn't good enough. As a scientist, I want to check on the facts. And for this issue, checking on the facts is easy. We arrange for people to witness a crime, we let some time go by, and we then run an ID procedure. And for some of the people, we give this key instruction, we tell them the perpetrator may or may not be included in the lineup, and of course for the other people in the study, we don't give this instruction. And then we compare the groups, one with instructions and one without. Now, let me pause for a second to give you a sense of the science here. In order to translate these issues into actual research studies, we need to deal with a bunch of details. I mean, what crime do we use? How much time should we let pass? What kinds of people should we recruit for our study? With questions like these, most scientists would say that we should try running the study in a bunch of different ways and ask how the details matter, or ask whether the details matter. So that's what we do. Unfortunately, though, this creates a new problem. If we do a bunch of different studies, how do we put the data together? How do we form our summary? The answer these days usually relies on a fancy and rather sophisticated method called meta-analysis, and I should just say, if you read research in this domain at all, you'll run into meta-analysis again and again. The term refers to a carefully designed statistical procedure and a whole bunch of mathematical formulas for doing an overall analysis of large data sets. Now, one strength of meta-analysis is its scope. It lets you pool very large quantities of data. You'll see that in just a second. So it really gives you a good handle on what's going on. Another strength of meta-analysis lies in the use of very clearly defined rules for deciding what kinds of data are going to get included in the study. That's our prohibition on any sort of cherry-picking. You don't just include the data you happen to like. So what does the meta-analysis tell us? There have actually been a couple of meta-analyses in this domain, but the most powerful one drew its numbers from studies that, as you can see, literally included thousands of participants comparing these two conditions. So we've got a fairly good sense of the data. And if you don't instruct the witness prior to the lineup that the perpetrator may or may not be present, then in these data, 44% of the selections are still correct. However, if we do give this instruction, accuracy jumps up by almost a third to 56%. So we're not talking about a small effect here. In addition, this is the pattern that we get if we look at all of the data as one package. But we can also break the data into sections and look at it part by part. Specifically, we can look first at the lineups that did include the actual perpetrator so that the guilty party is one of the faces that's out in front of you. And second, we can look at the lineups that happen not to include the perpetrator. That is, lineups simulating what would happen if this time around the police suspect happens to be innocent. Now, the results are as clear as can be. If the perpetrator is there in the lineup, you see him, and the instructions just don't matter. The accuracy is 53% in one condition, 54% in the other condition, basically no difference. The real payoff of the instruction, though, comes if the perpetrator is not included in the lineup. Without the instruction, accuracy rate is 35%. With the instruction, accuracy jumps to 60%. Giving the instruction, in other words, essentially doubles the accuracy rate. Now, this is, I think, extraordinarily good news. All we need to do is to convey some words of instruction. Time required, oh, maybe 1 or 2 or 3 seconds. Expense, zero. Benefit, we seem to lose none of the good picks from the lineup, but we eliminate half of the bad picks. I assume you'll agree that the cost-benefit ratio here is about as good as it gets. But against that backdrop, what is standard practice in Oregon? The fast answer is it varies. Most officers in this state do give some version of the pre-lineup instruction, but many do not. And there is no consistency, so that some officers use a clear, excellent version of the instruction, and some use a lousy version. So as you can tell, my view is going to be that we're in need of standardization on this point. Now, what's the evidence for these claims? Well, in 2010, one of my students surveyed almost 200 law enforcement officers throughout the state. The survey was supported, by the way, by Steve Weiniger at the DPSST, and I want to take a moment to thank Steve both for his support and for his advice in helping us to design this survey. In any case, the survey drew participants from sheriff's offices and police departments and the OSP. Most of the participants had more than a dozen years' experience, so we're looking at well-trained, well-experienced officers throughout Oregon. The survey told us that for 75% of these investigators, the only formal training they'd received in running ID procedures was the bit they got at the Basic Police Academy. 2 years ago, Chief Weiniger told me that this is often about 10 minutes of instruction on IDs within the Basic Academy. Let me be clear, this was not because the DPSST thinks this is a trivial issue. Instead, the Basic Academy simply has a lot of ground to cover, a lot of topics that need to be included in police training, with the result that some points, including ID procedures, got very little coverage. Now, I was delighted to hear this morning that things are moving on this issue at DPSST, but as recently as 2 years ago, when I talked to Chief Weiniger, the sum total of the training we were providing police officers on this issue was about 10 minutes. Therefore, if you're looking for consistency, that sort of training is far less than you would need. Even so, the good news is that, for the most part, pre-lineup instructions are usually given in Oregon. In our survey, 88% of the officers told us they always give us a pre-lineup instruction. Another 11% said they give it most of the time. That's excellent. But on the downside, we were quite discouraged when we asked the officers, is there a procedure in place for conducting a photo lineup with a witness who is not fluent in English? Almost two-thirds of the investigators told us that there was not. Likewise, is there a procedure in place for conducting a photo lineup who is mentally impaired? 93% told us there was not. So overall, we're doing well, but there are surely some gaps. Far more troubling, though, is the variation from jurisdiction to jurisdiction in exactly what we tell witnesses before a lineup. Some jurisdictions have rather clear language for what's called the pre-lineup admonition. Some jurisdictions, however, use language that, on my view, is not at all clear and which simply fails to get the point across. And by the way, I brought some samples with me of actual admonitions given around the state, and we can talk about them later if you like. These are the admonitions actually in use. But it's also important that some jurisdictions leave it up to the officer what to say, and so we just don't know whether the instructions are great, awful, or somewhere in between. Very few jurisdictions try in any way to check on whether witnesses understand the instructions, and some jurisdictions, including Portland, by the way, add extra bits that, according to the research, actually undermine the instruction. Oops. In addition, there's also variation within jurisdictions from one officer to the next. Some officers take the instruction seriously, others make it clear that they're just rattling off the instruction because they have to, and their tone and other things they say make it unlikely that the witness is going to take these crucial instructions seriously. My bottom line, therefore, is that we've got roughly the right idea in place in many jurisdictions, but we have done nothing to ensure consistency or quality control, and the consistency certainly is not there, and the quality control is absent, and the actual quality is at best rather variable. As a result, I think we're doing far less than we need to on this score. And again, this is a domain in which it's easy to do things right, and the cost-benefit ratio for doing it right is as favorable as it can be. All right, let me leave that, because I want to turn to my other illustration. Again, with the explicit message that I'm not trying this morning to survey the research in any systematic way. Instead, I just want to try to give you little snapshots of the research with the hope that you'll decide you want to learn more. So far, I've been talking about what happens before a lineup, and specifically what instructions we give to a witness. But let's also talk about what happens after a lineup. Obviously, police understand perfectly well that some witnesses get a good view of the perpetrator, some do not. Some witnesses have a clear memory, some do not. And for these reasons, police need to make a decision about how much weight to give a witness's input. And the usual way to do this is simply to ask the witness directly, "How certain are you?" And of course, if the police don't ask this question, sometimes the witness will just spontaneously blurt out things like, "That's him, I'm sure," or "I guess it was number two," or something like that. Now, this is powerful information. Studies make it clear that jurors put much more trust in a confident witness than they do in a hesitant witness. And in fact, judges encourage this because it's fairly common for judges to instruct jurors to pay special attention to how certain the witness said she was. But is any of that right? Is information about certainty actually useful in figuring out whether the witness's ID is correct or not? Think about Jennifer Thompson, who was as certain as could be, but had it wrong. Well, the first part of the answer here involves what we can think of as the best case scenario. In that scenario, a witness's degree of confidence is a decent but far from perfect indicator of accuracy. That is, in ideal circumstances, confidence and accuracy tend to rise and fall together. Now, I could give you a bunch of math here, some of which is reflected on the slide with the point by serial correlation value, which I'm sure is fascinating to you all, but let me make this as concrete as I can. Let's assume that half of our witnesses are correct and half are not, and we obviously want to know which are which. In that setup, a 0.43 correlation, which is the measurement we get in good circumstances, it's not hypothetical, it's the real measurement, that measurement translates into 70% of the high-confidence witnesses being correct and only 30% of the low-confidence witnesses being correct. Now, I hope you can see that this is a classic case of glass half full, glass half empty. If you're looking for good news, you'll notice that the accuracy rate is much higher among the high confidence witnesses. Therefore, you want to know whether the witness is confident or not, because that tells you whether the witness is in the likely to be right group or in the likely to be wrong group. But if you're looking for bad news, you'll notice that even among the high confidence witnesses, the accuracy rate is only 70%, which leaves a lot of errors. High confidence is by no means a guarantee of accuracy. So in short, confidence information is useful, but not perfect. But I've said several times now that this is the best case scenario. Why am I being fussy about this point? The answer lies in something called confidence malleability. Now, this term refers to the fact that there are several external factors that can powerfully change someone's confidence in ways that really matter for the justice system. Again, let me put this in concrete terms. Let's have some people witness a crime. We let some time pass. We then run an ID procedure. We then ask the witnesses how confident they are in their ID. However, for half the witnesses, we add one step after the ID, but before their confidence, we provide some further information. We might say, good, you selected our suspect. Or we might say, you know, another witness chose the same guy. In any case, the idea is that we provide what's called post-identification feedback. Now, what does this do? Well, the idea here is that in assessing their own certainty, witnesses are actually going through a somewhat complicated judgment. On the one side, they're considering the positives, like how familiar the suspect's face feels to them. But on the other side, they're also considering what doubts they might have. It's as if the witness has a balance scale in mind, with pluses on one side and minuses on the other. And of course, what the feedback does is eliminate the doubts. It eliminates the minuses. Now, how does that show up in the evidence? Well, in one study, half the witnesses were literally given the feedback, good, you selected our suspect. The other were given no feedback. The no feedback group, on average, gave a confidence estimate just under 50%. They said 50-50 in my choice. The group with feedback, though, gave a confidence estimate that averaged out to 70%. Now, let's be clear, both groups had seen the same crime, had gotten the same view, but thanks to just five words of feedback, one group suddenly has much more confidence in their pick. Now, there's another, and I think more important way to think about these data. What you've got on this slide are averages looking at all of the participants in the study. But we can also zoom in for a closer look. And we can simply take account of how many witnesses said they were 100% sure. These are especially witnesses to keep track of because these are the witnesses who are going to be particularly persuasive to law enforcement and particularly persuasive to jurors. As you can see, only a handful of the no feedback participants gave this response, you know, fewer than 1 in 10. But what happens if we add feedback? Now a very large number of participants give us the strongest possible response that we allow. Now, this is a highly reliable result, and in fact, we can give the feedback in a dozen different ways, including telling the person that we've made an arrest, or letting the witness see the suspect's picture in the media. Across many variations, across many studies, we get the same result in study after study. But why should you care about this? I mean, what's the big deal here? Well, actually, these feedback effects create several problems for us that I would regard as edging on disaster. First, let's bear in mind that, as I said before, many people rely on a witness's expression of certainty in deciding how much to trust that witness. So if we inflate the degree of certainty through feedback, we are artificially making witnesses seem more believable, and so we are, in essence, manipulating courtroom evidence. And that's worrisome. Of course, the law is clear. You cannot tamper with a witness. Police and attorneys are forbidden to tell witnesses to alter their testimony to make it more favorable to their case. But that's essentially what feedback accomplishes. In that way, feedback is, I would suggest, a perfectly legal form of inadvertent, unintended witness tampering. And in my view, that's just wrong. Second, and for reasons I'm not going to drag you through, it turns out that the impact of this feedback is greater for some witnesses than for others, and it's greatest for the witnesses who are likely to make a bad pick from the lineup because they've got weak memories. Now, these are, of course, the witnesses who can mislead an investigator, and so they're the witnesses we want to listen to least. But thanks to the feedback, it's precisely these witnesses who will be especially believable, and so the feedback creates a danger that these are the witnesses we'll listen to most, exactly the opposite of what we want. All right. I hope it's clear, therefore, that I'm marching toward a policy recommendation in which we need to avoid these feedback effects. Indeed, these effects have to be avoided for yet another reason, because they do further harm in addition to what I've already described. Let me skip all of the details and simply think about a witness who got some feedback. Let me skip forward a bit. And then made a pick. Okay. When we give the witness feedback, what the witness is likely to do is to say to herself, well, I got the right answer, so I must have gotten a good view after all. On this basis, the feedback might do more than just influencing the witness's confidence. The feedback might, in addition, change how the witness remembers the crime itself. In one study, witnesses received no feedback, and they said correctly that they did not have a good view of the witness, of the perpetrator. They did not have an easy time making their ID, and they were not at all certain in their ID. But what happens if we do give participants some feedback? Now everything changes. These participants got exactly the same view as the first group, but it sure looks like the feedback leads them to rewrite history and to remember things in a fashion that's completely out of step with reality, but completely in line with the feedback they've received. Again, though, let me pause, if I may, to give you a sense of the science and to highlight a worry that I suspect has already entered your thoughts. I'm describing artificial laboratory studies here. Participants in these studies know that they're in an experiment, they're not in real police investigations, and obviously this is a huge difference. Researchers take this point seriously, and we deal with it whenever possible by cross-checking our data against data gathered out in the real world. This is an important part of research in this arena. So, as just one example, one research team studied feedback effects in a real police station with real eyewitnesses after an ID is part of a real investigation. And what happens? We get exactly the same result as before. If I can zoom in on just some of the data, witnesses who were given positive feedback reported that they'd gotten a better view and made their ID more quickly, although that was utterly false. And in fact, witnesses also made a broader claim, and after getting feedback, they now insist that in general, they have great memory for faces. And they tell us, they boast about what good memories they have the study. All right. In light of all of these findings, what adjustments do we want to make in Oregon? First, I've already said that confidence is an imperfect index of witness reliability, but it's a decent index, provided that we collect confidence the right way. Therefore, I want police to collect confidence, but I want to make sure they do this without feedback. Okay? What's the reality here, however? In one state, in our statewide survey, one-third of the investigators we talked to said they collect confidence information less than half the time. And if the witness blurts out on his own how sure he is, half the people we talked to said they might not write it down at all, and 5% said they never write it down. So we are, in other words, rather systematically failing to collect information that is useful. In addition, at risk of stepping on some toes, let me be clear that if you don't collect confidence at the time of the ID itself, then it's just bogus, it's just nonsense to ask someone their confidence later after they've received feedback. For example, after the witness knows that the suspect is on trial. In that situation, there's no way to know what the confidence would have been without the feedback. It's like my giving a quiz to my students at Reed, but telling them during the quiz what the right answers are, and then somehow giving them credit for knowing the right answers. I gave them the right answers. They shouldn't get credit for it. That would be silly. But I'm sorry to say, we often have cases just like that in which there's no confidence information collected at the time of the ID. We, via feedback, basically tell the witness what their confidence should be, and lo and behold, we ask them how confident they are. This very common practice is, I think, just indefensible. It assumes that feedback effects don't exist, and that's just nonsense. In any case, let me press on. Do police officers in Oregon give feedback to witnesses? Well, in our survey, many witnesses said they do chat with witnesses during the ID procedure. And so, for example, if a witness is hesitant about making an ID, almost 20% of the law enforcement professionals step in to encourage a choice. Again, this is a serious mistake. This is a flaw in our procedures because, among other things, this encouragement to make a choice completely undercuts the very important message in the pre-lineup instruction, which had said it's okay not to make a choice. Worse, roughly a quarter of the officers we surveyed said they give feedback at least half the time, and if they do give feedback, almost half told us they gave that feedback before collecting confidence information. This is, again, a flat-out mistake. This is a step that makes the confidence information worthless. We're doing this the wrong way in this state. So, if I had my way, therefore, we'd have clear guidelines on these issues to achieve consistency statewide and correct practices statewide. The guidelines would indicate what the pre-lineup instruction should be and would urge the collection of confidence information, but without any feedback. And if I had my way, police would routinely tape record ID procedures. That way we could double check later to make sure everything was done right, and then we could shut down any challenges over whether the instructions were given properly and so on. In addition, we obviously need to know whether a witness got a good view of the crime or not. We want to know what the lighting was and how far away the witness was standing. But here, too, I think we're doing things rather badly. Police routinely fail to record this information into their initial police reports because they're counting on the witness to remember this information. And the simple reality is that witnesses are terrible at remembering this information. And so this is a regard in which once we understand how memory works, we end up improving the quality of police reports. Okay, as you can see, therefore, the science on all of these points has a series of implications, many of which I hope would be uncontroversial and easily implemented. And I realize I've now gone on at far too great a length, so let me just take one more minute in order to touch very quickly on just one or two points that I've skipped past this morning in the interests of time. Research also makes it clear that identification accuracy is much better if lineups are constructed carefully and correctly, that is, if fillers are chosen the right way. This is another regard in which procedures across the state are pretty good, but not very good. There's a lot of bad lineups being used. That's something we should be fixing. Finally, there are also some other steps that researchers would recommend. I've skipped by these this morning simply in the interests of brevity. There's something called the sequential lineup. There's a strong recommendation for so-called double-blind administration. I'm happy to discuss these points with you later. But I've tried this morning to focus on more modern goals, to make it clear that there are steps that would benefit Oregon a lot, would improve public safety, are powerfully rooted in top-quality, careful science, and which, remarkably, would cost us almost nothing. Thank you very much for listening, and I'm happy to entertain any questions you might have.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of all the findings that you presented, are there any states that have made policy changes that you would cite as a model that we should follow, or is the law still catching up?
There are many states that are making large steps forward. I think first in the nation at the moment happens to be New Jersey. One of the reasons why I think New Jersey led the pack was the structural fact that in New Jersey, all police officers are nominally under the command of the Attorney General, and so you've got a centralized office that can set policies for the entire state. That just made it logistically easier to move forward. Many other states are following the lead. The science on these issues is clear, straightforward. The DNA exonerations add a note of trauma to the science. And so I think at this point there are a dozen states that are teetering on the brink of putting new policies in place. Gail Meyer would be happy to provide you her stack of guidelines that are floating around in various legislatures. There really is a nationwide movement. Everybody realizes, from the defense side, the prosecution side, law enforcement, everybody realizes there are easy steps we can take to make things better, and we've got to take those steps.
All right, Senator Dingfelder, and then back over.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Professor. I actually, great minds think alike, because I had the same question. It was more on the lines of, did you look at other states to see how we can compare with other states and what we can be doing to improve our practices here? So you pretty much answered that
question. I mean, there are other states. I should also mention that there is also a model that's been offered at the federal level by the U.S. Department of Justice. My own view, for what it's worth, is that surely each state is going to want to set its own guidelines. Our law enforcement needs are, in some ways, unique to Oregon, because Oregon is Oregon. And so I don't think the state should be marching forward in lockstep, but certainly there are lots of models for us to work on. We do not have to reinvent the wheel. We could sort of pick and choose the bits we like from the available guidelines, making it, I think, relatively easy for us to move forward.
Just one quick follow-up, if I may. Do you see that other states, you mentioned about actually taping the eyewitness interviews, is that something that you're seeing other states doing, or is that still
a
new
taping? Other states are, and in fact, South Carolina, where the Ronald Cotton exoneration happened, has gone a further step in using the technology. They are now using computers to to run their ID procedures. In some cases, relying on the fact that pretty much every police vehicle has a laptop computer in it already, so that, I mean, where the cop goes, a computer goes. There's a number of other folks talking about, dare I say this, an iPhone app that will present the photos one by one. There's a number of ways to use the available technology. Again, I'm happy to say, at relatively low expense.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Not that I want to point this out, that Representative Wisdom is from North Carolina.
Proud of him.
You mentioned at the very beginning that, and you kind of addressed the West Coast for the exonerations, and that Oregon has not had any exonerations. It's not that there hasn't been effort on the defense side representing the individual to determine whether or not, in fact, evidence was solid for a conviction.
I mean, it's certainly the case that, I mean, convictions have been released, I mean, have been reversed for a variety of reasons. I mean, as it turns out, the exonerations have been concentrated in a small number of jurisdictions. At risk of triggering the stereotypes around the room, by far the majority of them come from Texas. And by far the majority of them come from Dallas County within Texas. That's just where they are. Some people have suggested this is a problem in Texas, that they're really messing up in their IDs. A number of people have said, no, just the opposite. This is a reason to praise Texas because they've been more honest about this than the rest of us. I'm not going to go there. My own view is that we probably should not be focusing on the exonerations because those are extreme events and those are rare events. I'm more troubled by the sort of garden variety misidentifications. As I said, the cases in which, I mean, in ordinary investigations, one in five witnesses is picking on filler, for heaven's sake. That's a problem that happens all the time and happens nationwide. That, for me, is, I mean, less dramatic as a red flag, but more universal as a red flag. That, for me, suggests, I mean, more powerfully, I think, that in Oregon and in everywhere else, we've got to do something about this issue.
Just a follow-up, just one more, Mr. Chair. And not that I want to get into the weeds on this, but you mentioned that, and you have it in your slide, and you said it too, about what I'm interested in is what are the extra bits that may actually undermine the instruction that is given. And you mentioned, and you referred to Portland.
I'm mindful of the fact that Portland's district attorney-elect is in the room, so I'm going to risk trampling on his toes, or maybe he'll be exactly the right audience to hear these remarks. The Portland Police Bureau uses a printed admonition that looks like this. This was adopted by the Portland Police Detective Division in 2008. It, first of all, is too bloody long, and you're going to lose the witness's attention halfway through it. In addition, what the Portland Police Bureau does is a couple of things that are exactly right. They tell the witness, the guy may or may not be here, it's okay not to make a choice. But then what they do is give what researchers refer to as an appearance change instruction. It basically says, you know, let's be clear that the guy may look differently in this photo than he did at the time of the crime in ways we can walk through. There's a real common sense appeal to that instruction. That instruction, however, does more harm than good. Basically, it tells the witness, hey, don't worry about having a good match. If the guy's even close, go ahead and say, I choose him. So that appearance change instruction, if I were in charge, would be struck out of the Portland instructions. In addition, the Portland instructions specifically focus the witness's attention on individual features. Look at the guy's nose, look at the guy's eyes, and it turns out that we've got a mountain of research that says that makes face memory worse. The way we tend to remember faces is as an intact unit, as an overall pattern, and what you really want to do to improve witness accuracy is draw their attention to the whole gestalt and not zoom them in feature by feature, and Portland gets that wrong.
Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions?
Bill?
Professor, what is the when I looked at the second tape, it focused on the lineup, the throwdown, or whatever you call it. What is the appropriate way to conduct that? Because what I saw, taking the test myself, if it was conducted wrong, I was more likely than not to pick out the wrong person.
Yeah. There's a number of things that are, I think, important recommendations for running lineups. One of them is that, as I said before, if the bad guy is there, you tend to see him. The place the mistakes are most likely to happen is if the police use a lineup that happens not to include the perpetrator. And once you know that, it immediately shifts into a recommendation for the strategy of how you use lineups. Police should not be using lineups relatively early in the investigation when they're just sort of trying to clear away the brush so that they can focus on some people, because that means they're going to have a large number of long shots. That's where the mistakes happen. They should step to the lineup only when they're pretty sure that they've got a good suspect, which again emphasizes a point you heard earlier. What you want is the ID in conjunction with other evidence, in which case the ID becomes less of an investigative tool and more of a confirmation. That's important and I think comes out of the science. Second thing you want to do is to, as the extent possible, minimize any interactions between the police officer and the witness. They don't want to be chatting while the ID is going underway. And I participated in a review of a case in Josephine County a couple of weeks ago in which the officer and the witness were having a lengthy, friendly chat, picture by picture, as the ID went on. What a disaster that was. Okay. Third thing is the evidence is just getting stronger and stronger and stronger that we are better off with what's called the sequential lineup, not showing the photos all at once in sort of a standard six-pack, sort of like this. But what you want to do is show the photos one by one, and you only get to see photo number two after you've made a decision about photo one. You only get to see three after you made a decision. I can walk you through, if you like, the logic for that, but the evidence is piling up both in the lab and in a large number of field studies with real police investigations that's a better procedure to be using. So there's a number of things that we can do. They're a bit more cumbersome than the points I focused on this morning of instructions and feedback. And so I was this morning, if you'll forgive me, heading for the low-hanging fruit, the things that we can easily and quickly change. These other points are just as important.
Thanks.
All right. Any other questions? Professor, thank you very much for your time. So are we back with Mr. Bronson next?
Your sweetheart, somebody.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. My name is Bronson James. I am an attorney out of Portland. I handle primarily complex criminal litigation, both in state and federal court. And I think Bill asked me here mostly because I'm one of the few attorneys, I think, in the state that's actually reversed a conviction for improper identification procedures. So, first of all, I'm surprised that you didn't want to take five. So I commend you for your fortitude. And I'm sort of the CLE portion of this today's presentation. So I'm going to give you an overview of what the state of the law is with respect to eyewitness identification. And I'm going to do that in essentially four steps. First, I want to discuss kind of a preliminary framework. There's some definitions we need to get a hold of, and there's sort of a greater understanding of where eyewitness identifications play within the legal landscape that we all have to be familiar with. And then going to turn to federal law and how the federal courts have treated eyewitness identification, because that has served as the model for virtually all states going forward. And then I'm going to specifically talk about Oregon and how Oregon has treated eyewitness identification both in the past and most recently. And then finally, we'll do a brief multi-jurisdictional analysis. You can get an idea of what other states are doing and kind of how academia, with respect to legal academia as opposed to the psychological academia, has treated this subject. So the first thing in our overview that we need to get a handle on is a distinction that is critical to make in treating eyewitness identification in investigation versus evidence. So investigation would be, for example, using an out-of-court ID for gathering information to aid in detection. The police are trying to locate somebody. They want to know, is, you know, did you see this person? You know, did you see where they went, et cetera. This is investigatory eyewitness identification, and it is absolutely not what we are talking about when we talk about the law of eyewitness identification. What we are talking about is using an out-of-court identification, so the fact that a witness made an out-of-court ID, as later, as substantive evidence that would come into trial that the ID'd person is, in fact, the perpetrator of the crime. So that's what the law is concerned with, not the investigation, but its use later in trial as substantive evidence. That's the issue here, and it's important to keep that distinction in mind. The other distinction that is important for us to talk about is the sensory source. Now, we use eyewitness identification, and we typically think of it meaning exactly that, a visual observation, the use of the eyes to identify a witness. However, the term is somewhat more malleable and interchangeable because, of course, there are different ways to identify somebody. You may see cases that refer to something like an ear witness identification, but that same thing may also be referred to as an eyewitness identification. The terms are frequently used interchangeably. Auditory observation would be, for example, the masked gunman that holds you up, but you recognize the voice, and you're later asked to identify the voice by a series of recorded vocal. There have been cases, believe it or not, of smell identification out there, pretty rare, does happen, as well as tactile identification. So we're really using eyewitness identification, I would say 99% of the time, to mean, in fact, visual observation, but these other sensors do sometimes come into play. Now, the other thing that we need to sort of briefly discuss, mostly because I think it's an important context for how various courts have dealt with this issue, is that we have to understand where this issue fits within the greater criminal framework and what policy drivers you will see various courts considering as they evaluate the admissibility of eyewitness identification. On one hand, you'll see here up on the slide, we have what I've essentially called an ease of prosecution. Basically, what sort of there's a level beyond which we're not going to impose any more hoops to the prosecution because this is detrimental ultimately to public safety and security. But we also value at the other end of that spectrum the accuracy of the prosecution. And in criminal procedure, you will always see a variance as things move from one end of the spectrum and then come back again to the other end of the spectrum. And it goes throughout the criminal process, both pre-charge, so that'd be investigatory times, pre-trial, so someone has been charged but they've not yet been tried, in the trial itself, and then the post-trial. And you will see states that sort of organize their criminal procedure laws navigating these aspects of criminal prosecution and trying their best to stay within that very narrow bounds where you don't want to go too far to the end of ease of prosecution, but of course you also don't want to go to the extreme of absolute accuracy of prosecution, which frankly is an unattainable goal. So you will see courts, as they address this issue, put eyewitness identification and the rules and the law around it in this broader framework. And I think that is very important, particularly for a body like this to consider, because the legislature is often, and Lord knows I've been guilty of this in the past, people come to the legislature with very siloed issues. And so you often see a narrow sliver of somebody's pet issue of the day with respect to criminal process and procedure. But what that is somewhere on this line that issue fits, and how you alter the line ultimately drives the line in aggregate one way or the other. So it's important to consider this across the spectrum of the criminal process, and many courts, you will see, struggle with this. Okay. So, what types of considerations might it be important to keep in the back of your mind, and as courts have kept in the back of their mind, with respect to pre-charge criminal procedure when discussing ultimately eyewitness ID? One of the things that to keep in mind is Oregon search and seizure law. Oregon has a pretty robust search and seizure law. I would say that it definitely leans towards that green line, towards the accuracy of prosecution. Conversely, Oregon has a somewhat unusual grand jury procedure where, unlike, say, New York, New Jersey, Massachusetts, et cetera, where the grand jury procedures are more adversarial. So that's how Oregon's pre-charge criminal procedure stands. If you look at pre-trial procedures, important to always keep in mind the context of things such as discovery. In Oregon, I know at least four of you are lawyers, and probably like most lawyers, the majority of you are civil lawyers, and civil law is all about discovery. And important consideration in criminal law is that, you know, that whole section of the ORCP is about discovery. Well, criminal law, that just goes away. There is no criminal deposition in Oregon. There's no mandatory interviews of complainants or witnesses, like, for instance, criminal prosecution in Washington would have. Now, conversely, Oregon has pretty robust public records law that other states do not have. So there is the ability to get records in criminal prosecutions in Oregon that some states don't. And so that, again, as our line sort of flows through this procedure here. At trial, things fit into the rules of evidence, which is ultimately where eyewitness ID comes out. And there's a panoply of evidentiary rules that line purports, various hearsay exceptions, scientific standards, etc., and rules of proof. Standards for such things as confession corroboration, which I know came through this body a couple of years ago, accomplice liability, jury instruction standards, etc. And then finally, I think it is important, and I mention this virtually every time I'm asked to talk about criminal procedure to whatever body that I'm talking to, it is important to recognize that criminal procedure in Oregon is unique in that the procedure that we employ here with respect to juries is shared by only one other state, and that is Louisiana. Namely, that in Oregon, the jury only needs 10 of 12 to convict on any felony crime. It's exceptionally unusual. And that procedure shapes, again, where that line flows. And then, of course, there's post-trial. Oregon is also unusual and different than civil law. In criminal cases in Oregon, there's no judgment notwithstanding the verdict. That doesn't exist. Civil lawyers may be surprised to learn that. It does exist in other states. And then all of this sort of results under the rubric of judicial discretion, mandatory sentencing schemes, and I'm not in any way commenting on their validity or otherwise, but they affect the role of judicial decision-making, and they, therefore, affect how that line plays out. and ultimately appellate rights. Oregon has a very robust appellate system, but right now it's taking about 3 years to reach an appellate judgment. So as we go through this law, you will see that placing eyewitness identification in the greater rubric of the law has to always keep in the back of our mind sort of these various stages of trial and how the criminal procedural system in total shapes up for that jurisdiction. And you will see jurisdictions reaching slightly different results in part because of the different aspects of procedure they have in place. So let's turn then to the federal standard, federal eyewitness identification. It is grounded entirely in the due process. And that is a very important distinction and what makes the federal analysis of eyewitness ID so important and different. So eyewitness identification due process grounds really began in about 1968. There's little hints of it before then. But really the first case was a case called Simmons, which came out of the U.S. Supreme Court. They didn't do much with eyewitness ID rules at that point, other than to opine that bad IDs are to be avoided. You know, thanks, that was helpful, Supreme Court, but it didn't really give us much to go on. They did, however, address it a couple of years later in Neal v. Biggers, which was a pretty important case for eyewitness identification at the time. The important thing there is what the court said is that it was the likelihood of misidentification that really harmed defendants' due process rights. And we'll see this come back in later Supreme Court decisions, that it wasn't, what this foreshadows is that it's not the procedures that are necessarily violative of due process, it's the ultimately reliable or unreliable identification that can violate due process. And again, Biggers goes back to say that suggestive confrontations are disapproved because they increase the likelihood of misidentification. Excellent. Okay. So that brought the court up to its ultimate case on eyewitness ID, which is Mansus versus Braithwaite. And that occurred a few years after Biggers. I'm going to briefly go back through a little bit of the facts of the case, just because it's good to have a background of what actually happened. So there was a detective, a Connecticut detective. His name was Glover. He was an undercover narcotics detective, and he was trying to work a ring, a narcotics delivery ring, that they believe was orchestrated and run by Dickie Boy Cicero, one of my favorite names in all of criminal jurisprudence. I do not know what Dickie Boy Cicero looked like, but I view him as James Cagney, just because if your name is Dickie Boy, that just seems appropriate. So they're trying to run some undercover buys and try to work their way up the line to get to good old Dickie Boy. One of the things that they do, and they know that Dickie Boy is running this operation out of an apartment complex, but they're not exactly sure which apartment complex or which apartment within the apartment complex. So one undercover officer and Glover, along with a informant, go to an apartment that they think is going to be Dickie Boy's sort of stronghold, and they do a hand-to-hand buy. The door is opened about 12 inches. There's a quick exchange of cash, quick exchange of a bag of narcotics, and then they go away. Now, when Glover gets back to the station, he gives his description of who he saw at the door to the other officers there. And this is also, I think, what makes Manson versus Braithwaite really interesting is it's eyewitness ID, but here the witness is, in fact, the undercover officer. So we normally conceive of witnesses as being sort of detached from law enforcement, but these rules can apply to any witness who's trying to identify somebody, you know, that they don't obviously know. So Glover gives his description of the individual to the other officers. Well, there was an officer there. I'm losing my... we'll move on. There's another officer there named DeForno. Now, DeForno hears the description, and he says, "I think I know who you mean." And he goes and he gets a photo, a single photo, and he leaves it on Glover's chair. And Glover comes in and later, the next day, looks at the photo, the single photo, and says, yeah, that's the guy. And so that was the standard imposed in Braithwaite. And the court took that fact scenario, and what they outlined for the first time, really, was a comprehensive, essentially policy interests for the due process clause for eyewitness identification. First of all, they said that the most important thing that due process is concerned about is the reliability of the identification. That is the touchstone, is reliability. Now, here they also said that the secondary concern would be the deterrence of improper police conduct. This is sort of an important thing to recognize, too, for particularly for members of the judiciary committees. The deterrence rationale is something you find exclusively in federal law. All right. Federal search and seizure law is, and due process is motivated, in at least in part, sometimes almost exclusively, by the notion of deterring police improper conduct. Now, Oregon's constitutional prohibitions under our state constitution do not follow this deterrence rationale. That is not a concern of the, for instance, the Oregon Supreme Court when it's considering Oregon state constitutional rights. Instead, we operate under what's called a personal rights model. It's complicated. I'm happy to discuss it. But it's important to know that deterrence is sort of a uniquely federal. Then, of course, they said, well, we want the efficiency in the administration of justice. So, again, going back to those two lines that I had here, that's what Mance versus Braithwaite is laying out. We have reliability, namely the accuracy of the conviction at one end of our spectrum. We have the efficiency of administration of justice at the other end. And somewhere in between, we have to weave that line. And that line is going to be what is the court's substitution for the concepts of fairness and justice. So, the parties in Manson proposed two rules, and these are the parties' proposed rules. The defendant wanted a per se exclusion. So, if the method is suggestive, and pretty much everybody in Manson agreed, putting a single photo on the chair and saying, review it at your leisure, I think this is the guy, everyone agreed was suggestive. So, the parties, the defendant wanted a rule that said, if you obtained the ID by a suggestive procedure, it's out, period. There is no way to come back from that. The alternative rule was what's called a rehabilitative reliability, right? Namely that you can come back from, there is no point of no return. You can come back from an unduly suggestive procedure if there are other ways to establish that the ID was reliable, right? So what did the court ultimately do? Well, they set forth two things. First, they set forth a constitutional principle. They said due process does not require non-suggestive methods. That's not what due process requires. Due process demands reliability. And once you, essentially, once you accept that, then it's very hard to go with the per se exclusionary model that the defendant had offered. So they said that suggestive ID is nevertheless reliable by showing five factors. First, the opportunity to view and the circumstances around the viewing, the degree of attention the witness was paying, the detail of the description, how certain the witness was in making their description, and the time. And here they sort of conflate that. At times in the opinion, they talk about how quickly you're able to make your ID, so that's a temporal factor, but mostly what they're talking about here is how much time has elapsed between the incident to when you're asked to make the ID. So that was the last, really, that the United States Supreme Court saw of eyewitness ID for pretty much 30 years, up until quite recently, a case called Perry versus New Hampshire. And Perry versus New Hampshire involved suggestive ID procedures. But And there was extraordinary amounts of briefing, all kinds of amicus came in on Perry, hoping that the court might clarify the Manson versus Braithwaite standard, which they didn't do. Basically, because the issue in Perry was that the suggestive ID had not been conducted by law enforcement. It had been conducted by a third party. And so the question then became, does due process concern itself with suggestive IDs not conducted by law enforcement? Ultimately, Supreme Court said no, we don't care. And again, this goes back to the notion of that federal deterrence rationale. If there is no improper police or government conduct, then that deterrence rationale falls away. So Perry versus New Hampshire was not as helpful to the greater issue of eyewitness ID as one might have hoped. So then let's turn to the state. Well, shortly after Braithwaite came out, the Oregon Supreme Court heard a case also on eyewitness identification called State versus Klassen. Now, Klassen involved a residential burglary. A woman had hired two men, kind of semi-itinerant men, who had agreed to do some yard work for her. What happened is, so they worked for a few minutes, and this is directly from the case here, the court summarizing. One of the men went into the house while the other one stayed outside to talk to her. She noticed he never came back after a while. She went back into the house, noticed that some things were gone and a window was open, and he had been out the back window and was long gone. She then gives descriptions to the police, and they ultimately engage in a identification. Now, her description was of a white man being 5'4" tall, slender, weighing 150 pounds, with short, light hair and a Van Dyke beard. So the police then proceeded to give a photo throwdown procedure. She was shown 7 photos, but of the 7, only one of the individuals actually had a beard. She was shown those photos approximately 8 months after the burglary. And she was told by the officer that the officer believed the suspect was in this group of 7. So what Klassen then does is, Klassen ultimately, and here the actual results of the case are perhaps not as important as the rule that's announced, but the results of the case are that the court found that the witness's identification should have been suppressed, right? But they really reached that result by looking to a few key factors. First, the court was very concerned about the circumstances of the viewing, the fact that the viewing occurred in daylight as opposed to nighttime, for instance. Second, they were concerned about the witness's attention and her focus on the individuals. The court noted that she spent several minutes talking with them. There was no distractions around her. They talk about sort of the distractions that you might encounter in other sort of busy, crowded circumstances. But then they counted against her the time between the incident and the ID, and the fact that 8 months had gone by. And then her certainty, right? They also get talking about the fact that, you know, her description of the beard and what exactly the beard was, etc. More important than the resulting Klassen, though, was the legal rule announced by the Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court. And the Oregon Supreme Court announced a dual-prong test. So the first prong, and here this is evaluated by a judge, let me be clear, in a preliminary hearing. Was the ID unduly suggestive? Okay, that seems very much in line with the U.S. Supreme Court's termination of Manson versus Braithwaite. But here's where the Oregon Supreme Court adds a sort of wrinkle. They say, or did the ID needlessly depart from established procedure? That element right there, did the ID, the procedures of the ID needlessly depart from established procedure, is in no way present in the U.S. Supreme Court's opinion in Manson versus Braithwaite. That is a very unique Oregon gloss on this. So if the answer to either one of those two questions is yes, then the judge evaluating the admissibility of the evidence goes to the second problem. First, was there a source independent of the suggested procedure? Again, that is somewhat similar to the Manson versus Braithwaite. Or were there other aspects of the identification at the time the ID was made substantially exclude the risk that it resulted from the suggestive procedure? Now, here, the second prong of Klassen is similar to Manson versus Braithwaite, but there is sort of a subtle difference. Again, the U.S. standard was very much focused on reliability. What was the ultimate reliability? The second part of the Klassen rule is a little bit more focused on sort of a cause-effect relationship. Was there an independent source? Again, sort of tracing that cause-effect. Or were there other aspects that would substantially exclude the risk that it resulted? Again, that sort of cause and effect relationship. So there's a slightly different gloss. So the interesting portion of Klassen, and I think what has made Klassen so a bit of a head-scratcher over the years, is what was the source of law for the Oregon Supreme Court's decision? The Oregon Supreme Court based it on Manson versus Braithwaite, but then altered the fundamental test of Manson versus Braithwaite, right? So the court paid, you know, homage to Manson versus Braithwaite and the due process clause, the federal due process clause, but then sort of went beyond the federal due process standard articulated by the U.S. Supreme Court. Particularly the established procedure prong, again, that's beyond the standard, and the causal links are a little bit beyond the standard. So what is class and source of law? The court's never clarified exactly what source of law it drew it from, and subsequent decisions interpreting Klassen have acknowledged that Klassen is only sort of nominally grounded in due process, but has never really articulated exactly what it's grounded in. What we know, and again, an interesting point of unique Oregonness for the members of this committee, if you're not already aware, the words due process don't appear in the Oregon Constitution. There is no due process right under the Oregon Constitution. So could the court have grounded Klassen in some sort of Oregon version of due process? No, not likely. Could it possibly be grounded in Article 1, Section 11, guarantees to an impartial jury? Possibly. That might be a bit of a stretch, but if you're looking for some sort of anchor, it might be there. Another interesting possibility is Article 1, Section 33, which is the residual clause of the Oregon Constitution, says that any of the enumerated rights here aren't meant to, you know, overshadow any rights that might be reserved. The court has used that in the past. As a matter of fact, there's a great case about reasonable doubt. Reasonable doubt is also not provided for in the Oregon Constitution. There's no guarantee to proof beyond a reasonable doubt in a criminal prosecution under the Oregon Constitution. Supreme Court wrestled with that, and in a case called State versus Williams, found a guarantee to reasonable doubt in Article 1, Section 33. So the court has reached there to sort of get out of difficult conundrums before. Why is this all important as to how Klassen was grounded? Well, because Klassen very recently came up for a large challenge in the Oregon Supreme Court in a case called State versus Lawson. Lawson, again, involved an ID, and here it had been 30 years since Klassen. Science had changed. a lot of interested parties had come into the fore in this area. And Lawson just drew literally everybody and their dog got involved in the Lawson case. I authored an amicus. There were at least, I think, 8 amicus briefs filed in that Supreme Court case. It is still under advisement by the Oregon Supreme Court. We do not know what they're going to do with it. We also don't know if they do sort of uphold the Klassen rule, are they going to find the need to tie it into something more in the Oregon Constitution, or is it going to be simply tied to due process? Let's talk a little bit about the Lawson facts. The Lawson case is horrific on the facts. It is one of those classic nightmare cases. A couple are camping in their trailer. They come back to the scene and they find that the strange person is in their trailer. And they kick him out and he says, I thought the trailer was abandoned. So this strange individual then goes and sets up another campsite not too far away. Well, later that night, shots ring out and the couple is shot through the trailer. It's nighttime. They don't clearly see who shot them. At the time that happened, it was dark. The woman making the ID had been almost mortally wounded. She had a pillow over her face because the assailant then came in and tried to get car keys from her. And she only saw his profile. She made multiple failed attempts at the ID. She was eventually shown a single photo and then taken to a pretrial hearing where she could covertly observe the defendant as he was in court. Now, all the parties in Lawson, much like in Manson versus Braithwaite, everybody said, okay, yeah, this is unduly suggested. We all agree this is unduly suggested. The question was it nevertheless reliable? Now, what's interesting about Lawson is the Court of Appeals, we don't know what the Supreme Court's going to do, the Court of Appeals said, first, you know, ultimately a jury's in no worse position than a judge to determine the effect of improper police technique on identification. And secondly, you know, what about the fact that the unreliability of this witness was extensively discussed on cross-examination? There were experts that came and testified about memory, and the jury was specially instructed about memory. Doesn't that, in some way, cure the reliability? So, we've yet to see how Lawson is going to come out. Turning to sort of the general academic response to Manson versus Braithwaite, a key criticism is that Manson factors do not really preserve the judicial role as a gatekeeper of evidence. Studies have shown that the vast, vast majority of challenged identification, even when everyone acknowledges that the procedures are subjective, that courts will routinely, over 90% of the time, find them nevertheless reliable and admit them anyway. So many academics have criticized it for not preserving the judge's role as the gatekeeper of evidence. Second, the big academic response has been that it really lacks scientific grounding. And this is sort of a very hot issue on a number of fronts, particularly after a recent National Academy of Sciences report, that perhaps assumptions that had been made in the criminal justice system about the sort of reliability and the scientifically quantifiable reliability of evidence that we've taken for granted may in fact not be there. And so you're seeing this throughout the country. How have various jurisdictions dealt with it? Some jurisdictions have abandoned the federal scheme altogether, pinned it on their state constitutions, and instituted more controls, Utah being a good example of that. Some institutions have adopted, under state constitutional grounds, this per se exclusion. So if the procedures were suggestive, it's out. There's no rehabilitative reliability. New York and Massachusetts are examples of that. Other courts are resorting more and more to crafted special jury instructions about how the jury should perceive witness evidence. And throughout the country, we've seen an explosion in expert testimony in this area. Professor Riesberg mentioned it. I'm going to mention it again. New Jersey is a fascinating case. Without question, the largest single state case to address this issue in the last 30 years. The New Jersey Supreme Court has appointed a special master to go out and collect facts and statistics to report back to the New Jersey Supreme Court. That special master surveyed over 2,000 studies. I will be providing to Bill a copy of the New Jersey Special Master report. It's only about 65 pages long. It's like 165 if you include all the footnotes. Skip those. Just go straight to the body. But it's very good at encapsulating the state of the science and the state of the law right now. The New Jersey Supreme Court, based on that special master report, issued a 134-page opinion, which I have mercifully spared you from, and fundamentally re-altered New Jersey's standard for eyewitness identification procedures, departed from Manson versus Braithwaite, established a host of protocols, a lot of them tied to some sort of scientific grounding. So that's my, and I think I finished just on time. So that's a very encapsulated overview of the state of the law, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, any questions for Mr. Branson? Don't say that. Thank you very much for your presentation. That's going to bring us to our final panel. And for that panel, John Teague, Rob Anderson, Joe Simon, and Rob Underhill. And we do have one other presentation we're going to do after yours, so I'm not sure how much time y'all were planning, but if we could do it about 20 minutes or so. Thereabouts.
Okay. Ready?
Yeah.
Yes. Chair Polansky, other chairs, members of the committee, thank you very much for allowing us to speak today. My name is John T., Chief of Police for the City of Dallas, Oregon. Eyewitness ID was kind of over the horizon for a lot of law enforcement over the last 10 to 13 years, and it very recently has come above the horizon for us, if I can use that term again, as it began to appear in the trade journals. A tremendous amount of things can go to organizations like the Innocence Project, for example, who began to apply DNA evidence to overturn what we now know are wrongful convictions. This is a fascinating subject for a number of reasons. I began working on it last fall. Again, it appeared in one of our trade journals, and I began to read the trade journals, the academic journals, some of the academic literature, which I have access to through the Western Oregon University, and develop a policy for the city of Dallas. At the same time, OACP became aware of the issue and decided we need to press this out to our members. We developed a working group, which I chair. It consists of the chiefs of police organization, the sheriffs, district attorneys, DPSST, OSP. So we have a rather good cross-section of law enforcement within the state of Oregon. In trying to arrive at a model policy, we can strongly recommend to our members. We looked, again, at the trade journals, at the studies. We looked at what other states have done. Dr. Riesberg mentioned that New Jersey, Virginia, Texas, Rhode Island, IACP, International Association of Chiefs of Police. We looked at all of the work that they have done previously. I've never met Dr. Riesberg, never seen him until today, and I was happy to do so. His name came up not infrequently in those studies. It was delightful to see him. It's also delightful to listen to him because some of the recommendations that he has made, which he would seem to go as far as to say that there are some obligatory changes that need to be made, and I would agree, some of them are obligatory, and I'm happy to say that they appear in our model policy that we have developed. That model policy, it defines what a sequential versus a simultaneous presentation is, a presentation of photographs, because that isn't always familiar to all law enforcement officers. It promotes five important points, and I say five because as you look at New Jersey and Rhode Island and all of these other states, they offer up a cafeteria of suggestions to their constituents. But there's five that rise prominently. We made sure we included all of those in our model policy. Well, those are the blind administration of presentations. That is, the officer does not know who the bad guy is, or a blinded presentation. The officer makes a presentation in such a way he does not know which photograph the witness is looking at. Sequential presentations, and Dr. Reisberg touched on that. Rather than showing six pictures at once, we show the pictures sequentially. Instructions to the witness. Dr. Reisberg stressed that at length. Let me tell you real quick what we've done. We have, and he also mentioned the need to present instructions via a form. And we've made a form to make sure that the officers give the instructions rightly every time and thoroughly every time. Two of those sections from this admonition are these. One is that we tell the witness that we're going to present them a collection of photographs. And that does not mean that the bad guy appears in these photographs. We try to relay to the eyewitness that we don't know for sure, or we're not letting you know for sure, that the guy is in here. In fact, the officer should be blind to this presentation, so even he may not know that they're in there. We also note that if there is a photograph of the suspect in the collection, pick that photograph. But if there is not, don't pick any photograph. You don't have to pick any photograph. Again, we're trying to remove the witness from the necessity to pick a photograph. These are two things he touched on. We find them very important, very compelling. There's also the taking of a confidence statement and the recording of the presentation. Another thing he mentioned that we should do. We like the idea of recording the presentations. We like the idea of taking the confidence statement. In the literature, it also talks about taking the confidence statement as immediately as you can. In other words, not waiting minutes, much less hours or days later, to obtain that confidence statement. By confidence statement, I mean the statement that the witness makes about the degree of confidence they have in the photo they chose. We want to capture that as soon as we can, immediately, and if we can, capture it verbatim. And if we can, we want to record it. That way it's presented accurately and rightly to the jury that makes it that far. In our model policy, we also include, we talk about show-ups. We include a form as well for the officers to read to the eyewitness when they're doing a show-up. That's a presentation of a suspect in the field. We have a procedure for non-English speakers. We also prohibit post-identification feedback. And we do this quite strongly. Following the presentation of a photo lineup, the presenter shall avoid any feedback that might identify the suspect or hinder further investigation. A significant point that Dr. Reisberg made. These changes, again, I'll say, are obligatory. We feel the importance of them. We feel the importance of them enough to make a model policy to impress that upon our members, not only through our associations, but through DPSST and through the OAA, the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. We think we've done a great job arriving at this policy. I feel confirmed in that, having heard earlier testimony. I'm going to go one step further and tell you that if we have a need, it is this. This has been talked about for years, and it is now obviously come to the forefront in Oregon, not only with us, with the defense attorneys, and with others. If there's a need, it is that DPSST be a good representation, a good conduit, provide good training on matters such as these, and be able to look out and do the research and feed that back to us quite strongly and reliably. You know, having said that, I'm going to leave it, and I'll take any questions if there are any.
What we're going to do is hear from everyone, and then we'll open up the panel for questions at that time.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Who's next?
Chair Pazanski, Vice Chair, committee members. My name is Robert Anderson. I'm a lieutenant at DPSST Public Safety Academy and in charge of the criminal investigations program that we train there. This problem came to light to me in 2009 when I saw the very video that you guys watched today. I devoted a significant amount of time. I devoted my master's program to this process and have written my thesis on eyewitness and brought to training to DPSST for the past 2 years that we are training every basic training recruit that goes through DPSST is getting additional training in photo lineup They're receiving a minimum of 1 hour in classroom. We're doing scenario-based training for the recruits, and we've also included this training into a two-hour class for the Detectives Academy, which we run twice a year. I'll just keep it really short. The key things that we're training are the things that Dr. Eastberg brought up. We're training process of choosing those filler individuals. How do you choose the right person? How do you choose people that aren't going to significantly give a clue of who the possible suspect is? The instructional process, what instructions are given to the witness or victim that is going to be looking at this photo lineup process. The feedback and the requirement to not give any. We're training and teaching them about the blind process, where the officer that's giving the photo lineup doesn't even know who the suspect is or if the suspect is present or not, therefore hopefully limiting the ability to give feedback even if they did know. Confidence statements and reliability is going by what the person says, not necessarily giving scales. And corroborative evidence. We have a huge pressure on, you know, this photo identification should be a piece of the puzzle. Okay, it should be a small piece in that everybody that's put together a puzzle, you know what the picture is, even if you're missing one or two pieces. So this photo identification should not be the key piece of evidence that you need to sustain all the way to a conviction. So that's what we're currently doing. We're hoping that in the future that we're able to also then push out this two-hour presentation that we do for the Detectives Academy out into our regional academy to get it out to the officers who are currently working instead of just the detectives and the basic recruits coming through the academy. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Joe?
Good morning, chairs and members of the committee. My name is Joe Simon. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Accreditation Alliance. And I'm here this morning to provide a brief overview of our accreditation process in the state of Oregon. Oregon Accreditation Program is basically a joint effort of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, Oregon Sheriff's State Sheriff's Association, and the Oregon Association of Public Safety Communications Officers. We currently have 102 professional standards that are based on contemporary best practices in our industry that agencies must meet. There are basically four parts to our program: application, self-assessment, on-site assessment, and review and decision on award of accreditation. All agencies that do attain or successfully attain accreditation must undergo an on-site review for reaccreditation every 3 years. This is a voluntary, self-motivated program, but we have generated a lot of interest over the last few years. We now have 46 agencies under contract. 28 of those have successfully attained accreditation, and many of those have attained reaccreditation. Key elements of our program include agencies having written policy, training, not only on that policy, but in critical areas of law enforcement, review of their practices and analyses. In other words, basically what accreditation stands for is constant self-examination of your policies, procedures, practices, and general operations to ensure that you're operating at the highest level of standards in the industry and providing the highest level of service to your community. I would also like to talk just briefly about the training aspect, because that is an area that many of our agencies struggle with, because training is a key underlying element of the accreditation process. Not only it requires training in those mandatory areas, the state requires training on case law, high risk areas such as use of force, vehicle operation, and leadership. And unfortunately, and this is just a side note, but unfortunately due to budgetary issues over the last few years in this state, that is one of the areas that has been sorely degraded, is our ability to provide continuous training or have people access that training. So many departments now are forced to either self-develop that training internally or access other outside sources, which is difficult and expensive. So I will leave it at that.
Thank you. Well, good morning, Chair Przanski, Co-Chairs Barker and Krieger. Thank you very much, members of the of both houses. I appreciate being able to come and kind of be the last speaker before questions here. And it's great to know that, you know, you're we're checking up on how we're doing. That's exactly what this process is about, is to double check and make sure that we in law enforcement and public safety, to include the defense bar and the judiciary, are all making sure that we are convicting the right people. First, it is worth noting and taking a moment to recognize that Oregon does have a robust system for making sure that that is the case. It is worth noting that we do not have individuals that have been exonerated during this process of exoneration panel throughout the nation. It is not enough to say that and then be done with our efforts, however. It is important for all of us to continue to strive for perfection as best we can. The evolving science with respect to eyewitness identification is just that, and we are wise to listen to people like Professor Riesberg and others as we continue to learn and develop the best practices to add to other forms of evidence that have been gathered pursuant to an investigation. Now, one of the, Dr. Riesberg and I have met both in and out of the courtroom. We've had the opportunity professionally to, you know, work on the same cases while having conversations outside the same courtroom as well. Other defense attorney members here, you know, I know personally as well as professionally. The good news about all of this is that all of us are working together to take this issue seriously. It's evidenced by the fact of this this work group that has been put together, as has been touched upon by the sheriffs, chiefs of police. The Oregon District Attorneys Association has asked me to be a member of that work group. DPSST, all of us are interested in consistency and getting to the right result and making sure that we are convicting the right people and not charging anybody inappropriately. There is one area that I want to point out. I'll say we tend to agree much, much more than disagree with everything you've heard. Everything you've heard is very, very helpful for all of us to listen to, acknowledge, and work toward being the best we can. There is one area that I want to draw somewhat of an exception to and then talk about a little bit. And that is at least the notion that there is an inadequate sense of checks and balance relative to out-of-court identification. I think, to be fair, that when Dr. Riesberg said that we had quality control as absent was a quote, I think he was really focusing more on that in-the-moment identification at a law enforcement investigative stage. I think that's to be fair. But let's remember all of the checks and balances that are in place. And Mr. James did a good job of summarizing the law and walking us through the system, but I think it's worth additional comment. First, remember, eyewitness identification is often meant to buttress or corroborate, or in other words, support a tremendous amount of other evidence. Today's investigations include not just DNA, which we've heard about, but they include oftentimes forensic evidence in the form of fingerprints, hair analysis. They include such things as cell phone and electronic device evidence. They include direct and circumstantial evidence, chains of circumstances that are not built at all with eyewitness identification, but a series of other chains of events that are put together. Together with surveillance cameras and those kinds of things that we often find as part of, say, a robbery to 7-Eleven and those types of things. Together with, of course, the suspect's own statements and things of that nature. I've summarized, in essence, what an investigation can bring forth. But remember that eyewitness identification often finds itself as a corroborative piece of a tremendous amount of other pieces of evidence. The other thing to do is note that eyewitness identification, that piece of it, is a product of, first, we do need to have good policies and procedures in place. We do need to have solid implementation and training of those policies and procedures. But then, once we have those, it's how is that identification made? And that's what we spent a lot of today checking on, and that's a very important piece of it. But here's where the quality control takes place. And that is, once that identification is made in conjunction with all the other, the bulk of the other evidence, it is going to go to your prosecutor's office for a clear vetting of it at stage one. And I just want to bullet point these real quickly and then move along for questions. But the prosecutors are going to evaluate that. And the cases that we're primarily talking about, they're then going to go before a grand jury for additional vetting, a group of seven citizens who are likewise going to look critically at your presentation. Following that, if there is an indictment, and chances are we're always talking about those cases that go beyond the presentation to just a grand jury, but an indictment, you then are going to turn it over to members of the Oregon Defense Bar and their investigators. And this is where this system of justice really can be proud of itself, and that is we have a very qualified defense bar. They do a good job at keeping prosecutors and law enforcement's feet to the fire of doing the right thing and testing and making sure that we are doing it properly. They've got a team of investigators, likewise, that are well-trained and very good at what they do. To the extent they perceive a problem with the investigation, the status of it, and the nature of it, then they are going to be very swift in filing essentially a motion to suppress. They're going to bring before an Oregon member of the judicial bar, and they are going to vet that concern in a pretrial hearing. We are going to have sometimes hours, if not half a day, if not days, worth of litigation over those concerns. And we're going to have a member, we're going to have a circuit court judge listen to all of it and make an appropriate decision. But that's not all, because if the decision is to allow it to come into evidence, it's not as if that quality control is done. The evidence then is presented to a trier of fact, and ultimately the trier of fact must determine its weight. In other words, its reliability and ultimate weight. Again, in conjunction with oftentimes a tremendous amount of other evidence. But we're not done with that quality control right there. If the defendant is convicted for the offense, then there is yet another series of opportunities to double check our work. We go to the Oregon appellate courts, the Court of Appeals, the Supreme Court, if it goes beyond that, to double check all of our work relative to the Claussen standard and the rights of, and I agree with Mr. James, it's not exactly a due process evaluation. It's something of a bit of an anomaly, it's a bit of a hybrid. But it works, and it's working very well. And it's not just done there. If by chance a defendant remains convicted, he then gets an opportunity to complain, if you will, about the quality of counsel. Did counsel do something wrong? And that's a post-conviction relief hearing. They can address those concerns at that stage. So the good news is we are striving to do better. We're all working together. We want to be in the same place. We're happy that this to engage in these conversations, because they do make us better at what we do. And so it gives us an opportunity to visit that. But it is worth noting that we in Oregon do enjoy a rich, rich system of justice here, for which we should be proud of. Thank you. And I think all of us, four of us, are prepared for questions if anybody has any.
All right. First, Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Chair. A wrongful conviction regarding misidentification. I can't think of anything more horrible for the person, but you have the family members. This gentleman we saw was in jail for prison for 11 years. That's something. And the last word you used is something that I have not heard often in this room. I visited with the State Bar last year. Representative Provansky was there. Senator Provansky, Representative Garrett. In an hour and a half, the word justice never came up. We got to make sure it does. And Gail, I would hope that you would work with them and the groups, gather stuff together. If there is something we need to do as a legislature within statute, make sure we understand what that is for 13 legislative session. If this could be done in-house, the BPST and that, kind of define those parts for us too, please.
Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Simon, so what proportion of law enforcement are accredited?
What proportion? Currently in the state we have 18% of our agencies are accredited.
Thank you. And Mr. Underhill,
yes.
Is law enforcement in Multnomah County accredited?
I don't know. let me ask at the end of the table.
You currently have two agencies in Multnomah County that are accredited.
And they are?
Fairview and Troutdale.
Thank you. Follow up?
Yes.
Mr. Underhill, would you be interested in following up on that? I'm making sure Multnomah County is accredited.
Well, first I want to make sure, well, we've got Portland Police Bureau, we've got Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, right. Gresham Police Department, Oregon State Police, a little bit of Lake Oswego. So we'll double check with exactly what that means, and I'll make sure that that we have the proper contact information for the chiefs of police and the sheriffs that I've just mentioned.
Thank you. And if you would get that information to me, I would appreciate it. I
yes.
represent part of Multnomah County. And last question.
Yes.
So, Mr. Underhill, one of the suggestions of Dr. Reisberg was that Portland, the printout that is given to witnesses is too long, so which makes it useless. Is there any interest on your part in making that a more valuable question?
Not to quarrel, but I don't think that Dr. Reisberg says it's useless. His comment is, I think it's not as good as it could be. And what I mean by that is the Portland Police Bureau's admonishment prior to the selection process or the identification process is, in his view, wordy. It's a balance between being too brief and being criticized for that, too wordy and being criticized for that. We have done a lot of work in this area because we take it very, very seriously, not just in Multnomah County, but everywhere. But certainly, my purview is Multnomah County. We spent a lot of time. In fact, Dr. Reisberg, given the opportunity, would tell you that he's been in to do trainings with the Portland Police Bureau to assist them with the proper procedures for identification. We don't always agree on everything. We agree on a lot of things. We agree on much, much more than we disagree. So while his suggestion is we've got a phrase in there or two, I think it is what it is, that may be not as assistive as it could be, that doesn't mean that we 100% agree with him.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a quick follow-up for whoever wants to answer this, and you answered part of it through Representative Tomei's question about one question I had is about standardization of the actual instructions. Is there a reason that we have to have some cities and some jurisdictions have different? It sounds like we may benefit from having a standardization to make sure we have consistent policies throughout the state. Is there a reason we don't?
You know, I don't know that I'm, if you're asking
me. Whoever wants to answer it, it could be.
Well, in our model policy, we do have a suggested admonition that is attached to our model policy. And it relays all of the information that's been suggested that we provide, without providing too much, by the way.
And just a quick follow-up. Dr. Reisberg had, in his presentation, he had talked about training but also mentoring, and I didn't hear the word mentoring at all in the discussion. So I heard a lot about training at DPSST. Mr. Underwood, you talked about the training in Multnomah County. I would imagine that there's a lot of officers that are not necessarily going, I don't know how often they're going back to DPSST, but can you talk about training in the field and then mentoring, obviously, to make sure that folks who are the officers that are actually performing these duties have some role models or being trained in the field?
You know, what I'd like to do is I'll volunteer for answer part of that question from the prosecutor standpoint up in, say, from Multnomah County, which I'm familiar with. First, there is ongoing what we call advanced academy training. For example, in Portland Police Bureau, using them as an example, for years, in fact, I participated in that in different areas. Sometimes it was domestic violence training and how to properly investigate domestic violence cases and such. There's sex abuse training. There is eyewitness identification training, search warrant writing training, those kinds of things where the Advanced Academy will take up issues that are very, very important and continue to train their investigators. We participate and have for a number of years. One of the things to maybe you all could help us with is through the recent budget reductions for all of us, those kinds of training opportunities have been reduced. We are all better served by having those training opportunities not reduced but enhanced. Of course, that's a resource. It takes time, energy, and it takes money oftentimes. So in the last few years, my office has done what I would describe as less of those kinds of trainings than we have in the past for the reasons I've just touched on. So it's something for all of us to note, be aware of, and do as best we can to do something about. We are going to be better with training. There is, and these two gentlemen are going to be better at describing the mentoring type of training. What I mean by that is when a person comes out of the academy, it's not that they're put on the street all by themselves and away they go. They're going to have a field training officer or officers, plural. They're going to stick with them for a substantial amount of time. After an individual has been, say, promoted off the street onto a detective role, where you're going to see a fair amount of this and probably the most amount of what we're talking about, they're going to have training all over again at the Detective Academy role of things. They're going to be trained on any number of things, to include the proper process, the best practice in this area as well as others.
All right, I'm going to put the answer there. Thank you very much. I have two more people who want to ask questions. I got another panel that needs to come up, and we've got to be out here before 11. So, Senator Courtney.
Well, yeah, this has been asked, and stop me, Chair Brzezinski. Thank you. I'm just curious. Officer Underhill, now, the DPSST trains the local and the county and the state police in terms of training. Isn't that correct for all, for the entire state? Is that right?
I'm
talking to you, Officer. Yeah. Is that correct? Okay.
Yes, I believe that's correct.
I want to talk to the training officer, Deputy. I don't mean to disrespect you. I'd like
you
to
said Underhill. I'm sorry.
I said Officer Underhill. Is that correct? Because you're connected with the facility out there, Department of Public Safety and Standards. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. That is correct.
Okay. Now, Chief, here's the situation, Chief Teague. I'm fascinated. You're Dallas. Now, I have Jervis in my district, Woodburn, Salem. I find myself thinking, and I can't speak for the other people here who have smaller communities in their districts. Is there in this state, in this issue, because you, the smaller communities, how is this all playing out there versus the big Portland and everything? Are there more issues, there are more struggles, more barriers, simply because of geography thing, or is it universally the same? And I find myself wondering about that. Do you understand my question, Chief?
Yes, sir.
Not to say that you're real small, but I know Dallas because of Monmouth and Western. So can you help me with that?
There's two factors at play there. One is small agencies, and by the way, every agency in Oregon is a small agency. Small agencies struggle to identify things like eyewitness ID that need to be fixed, if you will. So having the capacity for having a locus in the state that possesses the charge to identify these things and work on them is vitally important to us. And that's a fancy way of saying DPSST, we rely heavily upon DPSST to recognize things like this and to vet them and produce them and to develop policy for us. It's vitally important for us. And then, so moving to the second part of your question, it's important to us that DPSST especially be able to educate and train the smallest of small agencies in how to conduct things like eyewitness identification presentations. This is not rocket science at all, by the way. And a new cop that learns how to do this will never have any idea that there's ever another way to ever do it. And a new cop, by the way, would never produce this to an eyewitness apart from seeking out how to do it. But we need to make sure that the executives in the very small agencies understand the policies and understand how to implement that training at their agencies.
Thank you, Chair.
Yes,
sir. All right, Representative Hicks.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll keep it brief. Dr. Riesberg did say this, but I think it bears repeating. It was on or around slide 93, that he had evaluated hundreds of photo lineups in Oregon, and the standard is, by and large, very good, or use words to that effect. And so I simply want to commend Oregon's law enforcement agencies for subjecting itself to that close scrutiny and adhering already to standards that have produced that kind of result. And so we seek forever to optimize our approach, but I don't want it to be lost as we conclude this discussion for today that even now, per Dr. Riesberg's analysis, Oregon is doing a very good job in this area. Thank you.
Representative Shoffler.
Yeah, briefly, Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm glad you touched on money, Mr. Underhill, because that is a big problem in the state, and there's a big problem in this building because there are people refuse to accept the fact that we need to pass policies to get people back to work in this state, and in natural resources, timber, water, agriculture, mining, road development, bridge construction, energy production and distribution and transmission and exportation and importation. Absolutely refuse to recognize that. While one in five Oregonians are on food stamps. So I'm glad you touched on the money part, and I'm confident with the makeup of the legislature next year, it'll even be more difficult to create those jobs in those areas. But thank you for coming. I really appreciate the presentation today.
I want to thank y'all as a panel. I want to thank everyone else that presented. And let's see, Mr. Bronson, if you can give us a copy of your PowerPoint, that would be great. But thank you very much for all the time you've put into it and the time that you're going to continue with the work group. It's very, very important. And if any way we can help you, don't hesitate to reach out to us. And we really appreciate the time and effort you're putting in. Thank you very much.
We're going to close this informational hearing. And we have one other informational hearing today, and this is going to be on a panel presentation and discussion on alimony, spousal support. Again, we have invited testimony. So as one group's moving out, we're going to go ahead and bring up the next panel. And I think we're starting off with the reasons for reform.
This upcoming one?
We're going to hear about
this alimony.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, they don't want it to change. Was it good?
Yeah.
Did you know that? Got it. Doesn't seem like to be like an area of the law where you can just have a formula based on the institution. You've got to have case by case analysis.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before you start,
my name is Robin Descamp, DES, capital CAMP.
When you're ready.
Okay. I want to start off by thanking all of you for agreeing to hear from us today. We are Oregon Alimony Reform. We're a grassroots organization that formed basically because we had many people in the state who were becoming more vocal about the suffering that they were going through because of their alimony awards and their inability to modify them, especially during the recent economic crisis, which I think most of us will agree still hasn't left the state yet. We have almost 100 members at this time, and we have a Facebook page, so we're very modern. Today I'm going to talk about a few things, and I just want to let you know that our PowerPoint presentation is still a work in progress, and I apologize I didn't have it to you all sooner, but we've been working tirelessly on this while also dealing with jobs and families, etc. So first I'm going to talk about what we do not advocate. I think it's important for people that there's a distinction between what we stand for and what we do not stand for, because opponents of alimony reform will try to paint us with a brush that really doesn't have anything to do with our story. So after I tell you what we're not about, I'm going to tell you what we do advocate, some basic pointers that we're hoping to get into a piece of proposed legislation that will help enact alimony reform that gives people more predictability in the outcome of what the award that they will be paying or receiving will be. Next, I'm going to share with you some horror stories. And finally, I'm going to end with asking about some next steps that I hope we can take going forward. Right, I understand that my time is limited.
It is limited, and based on the PowerPoint, hopefully you're not planning to try to go through all of that during your presentation, because we're not going to have enough time. I'm going to need to leave. Some of the other members may be able to stay after 11. I know some of us have other committees that we have to be at. I have to chair another one. So what I'm going to ask in your presentation, if you can give us the highlights, high points, and then we can always follow up with you. But if you're trying to get through this document before in this presentation, we're not going to have enough time.
All right. What I'll do is, because our horror stories are pretty detailed, you have the printout. I'll try to leave those out, and I'll get to really the meat of what we're proposing, which are the changes in the law. I just want to start also by saying I am an attorney, but I'm not a litigator. I'm a corporate attorney, and so forgive me, I'm not used to being in sort of court.
We have no robes and we can't hold you. Well, I guess we could.
I was going to say he has a prosecutor, so the chair is a prosecutor. So.
Oh, okay. So I'll just gloss over the first one. Alimony originally came from, I believe, England, and the purpose was to compensate non-working women, usually, when their husbands abandon them. It was also created and brought over to the States to recognize that spouses who stay home to raise children are going to be less competitive than their husbands. And forgive me for using the words wives and husbands, but even today, 98% of alimony payers are men, and 2% of payers are women. So there really is quite a gender gap, as you can see. Also, alimony was supposed to keep women off the dole, basically, so that the state didn't have to take care of people who were probably not, who knows, abandoned by their spouse. Today, 42% of all households have two income earners. That comes from the 2006 census, so I would bet it's even more today. U.S. Department of Labor, these three facts are reflected by a study they did in 2010. Women are 47% of the U.S. labor force. We will account for 51% of the increase in the total labor force between now and 2018, and that we account for 51.5% of the higher level jobs. So women are doing great and breaking all those glass ceilings. Now it's important for me to again say what we're not about. Oregon alimony reform is not proposing any changes to the child support laws. Alimony and child support are completely distinct, separate issues and should never be confused with each other. That being said, I will say that Oregon alimony reform respects and admires the child support calculator that is used in the state of Oregon and is used in every state in the country, and we would like to see a similar calculator being applied to alimony decisions. OAR is also not proposing that we eliminate alimony indefinitely. However any of our members may feel about alimony from a philosophical perspective, we agree that alimony is necessary for a certain amount of time for some people to get back on their feet after a divorce. Again, what I want to say before I go through the points of the law that we'd like to change, in every circumstance, we would allow for judicial discretion in compelling circumstances. This is when you have a recipient who perhaps has been injured and is no longer able to work. Perhaps they have some sort of mental disease or defect, or they're sick. Or whatever the circumstances may be, if it requires judicial discretion to go outside of the guidelines, we wholeheartedly support that on every point that I'm going to make today. So I don't want anybody to leave the room with the feeling that we want to take away judicial discretion, because we don't. So our first point is, in Oregon we have what we call indefinite alimony, and I'm making the finger quotes because we call it indefinite, and what that really means is lifetime. And I see it as lifetime because in order for a person to get a modification or an elimination of their alimony, they have to go through a very costly, both emotionally and financially, court process during which they're subject to discovery, they're subject to having to go to hearing after hearing, and they really can't ever get away from it without paying a lawyer a lot of money and then crossing their fingers and hoping for the best. So we'd like to replace indefinite alimony with a term limit of half the length of the marriage, but no more than 10 years. So a 25-year marriage would be 10 years of alimony maximum. A 10-year marriage would be 5. We would like automatic termination of alimony upon good faith retirement of the payer with no litigation required. There are many people out there right now paying alimony that cannot afford to retire, and at the same time, their spouse is drawing on their retirement account that was split during the marriage. So if you have a retirement account that's throwing off, let's call it $10,000 a month, somebody invested really well, their investment account is throwing off $10,000 a month, the payer is entitled to 5, and the alimony recipient is entitled to 5. And the alimony recipient is also at the same time collecting alimony. So the payer cannot afford to retire because he's still got to pay the alimony. So we'd like for people to be able to retire and be able to, you know, end their professional career or whatever they're doing and be able to enjoy the rest of their life. We would like, if a alimony recipient begins to live with a romantic partner for longer than 3 months, that triggers an automatic termination of alimony with no right of reinstatement. Reinstatement, I know, was a hotly contested issue a few years ago, and I would ask you all to put yourself in the place of an alimony payer whose former spouse moves in with people, and you think, okay, great, I'm going to get a break here, alimony's over, and then that relationship doesn't work out, so they move out, and then you get the alimony again. It makes it impossible for you to plan for the future if you don't have any, that if your entire future is dependent on the whims and the romantic relationships of your former spouse. Oregon Alimony Reform believes that alimony should be based on a percentage of the payer's income, not an arbitrary amount to be either negotiated between the parties or set by the courts. As you guys probably all know, roughly 95% of all cases, including domestic relation cases, settle before they get to court. When you have a child support case, you do not have litigation on child support almost ever, because there is a calculator that determines an amount, and that's a wonderful thing because it reduces the amount of money that the people getting divorced have to pay to their attorneys to get the thing wrapped up. With alimony, you don't have that. It's all a big question mark, and the only thing that you can do is look to judges' decisions in the past, of which, remember, that only reflects about 5% of all the cases. So people are really taking a stab in the dark when it comes to determining what is a fair alimony amount. So we believe that it should be set by a percentage of the payer's income and not an amount such as $5,000. We think it should be limited according to an income differential between the payer and the recipient. So if the recipient makes $50,000 a year and the payer makes $100,000 a year, the maximum should be 25% of the differential of $50,000. And 25% of $50,000 is what it is. I'm not a mathematician. I believe it's $12,500. We believe that each party should have the right to review the other's proof of income. We say proof of income instead of just tax returns because tax returns aren't due until April and some people file late. So we'd like to see the proof of income such as the W-2s, 1099s, K-1, including the and also the Form 1040 each year, and that the parties can make automatic adjustments if necessary without litigation. And because we're fair and reasonable people, we believe that if there's a percentage that's set by the court, then your income goes up and the recipient's goes down, then you have to pay the difference. We advocate that it can go up and it can go down, but you shouldn't have to engage the courts. We also advocate that assets and income from new spouses or cohabitators of payer should be excluded from alimony award proceedings. I myself, my husband pays alimony, and when the economic crisis hit a few years ago, he's a partner in a law firm, so as some of you may know, a partner in a law firm, their income can be wildly different from year to year, and even from month to month, and in his situation, his income took an incredible nosedive after his divorce. It was the best year that he'd ever had in his career, and his income then took a dive. And during his efforts to seek a modification, his former wife's attorney subpoenaed me. I had met his former wife once. She subpoenaed me and my ex-husband for 10 years of our financial records. She subpoenaed me for all of my checking account, credit card statements. She subpoenaed my husband for the cost of my 40th birthday party. So what I'm saying is it's inherently unfair for a new spouse or cohabitator to be dragged into the nastiness of this litigation when we have no part in it. My income is protected by a prenuptial agreement, as I believe everybody should be, and I strongly advocate for that. So ostensibly you would think that we could present them with the prenuptial agreement and say this is not relevant, she does not share her income with her husband, but that's not the case in Oregon. In Oregon, the statute says income from all sources, and that can include people like me.
Robin, I'm going to hate to do this, but I need you to wrap up in a couple of minutes because we got another panel that I need to get up here. And what I'm going to ask you to do is take these points that you have here that we're not going to be able to cover and get them in another piece if you want to give us another part of the presentation that you can get to Bill Taylor, and then he can distribute it to us. And I apologize just because of the timing that we have.
Okay, so I have a couple minutes.
Well, that we can go to. I think these things would be the stuff that if you want to highlight anything within those particular states, you should put that in writing electronically, and then we can get it that way.
Okay.
So if you have any closing comments that you want to make in the sense of, and what you've got here is very substantial, and the horror stories is something we can read through.
Okay. Okay, I understand. I'll wrap it up. Okay. So I just want everybody to ask themselves a series of questions when you're thinking about the subject of alimony reform in Oregon. The people who oppose reform will try to create a scenario in which you have a defenseless victim, and that's the recipient, and a strong and powerful payer. And that's really not the case. With the economic decline in Oregon, we have thousands and thousands of people who have not been able to get a modification in their alimony, despite the fact that their income has either gone to zero or has dropped significantly. So ask yourself, how would you feel if you lost your job and you were subject to an order of contempt by a court and possible jail because you simply could not find the money to support a person who is healthy, has a degree, or has training and could work for themselves but chooses not to? I would also ask you to ask what can be unfair about an alimony calculator similar to the one that's used for child support. There are three reasons that you can go to jail in this country, despite the fact that we outlawed debtors' prisons. Three reasons you can go to jail if you don't pay. One of them is if you don't pay your taxes. One of them is if you don't pay your child support. And one of them is if you don't pay your alimony. And alimony is the only one where we do not have a predictable way of calculating how much that amount should be and let it be modified over time. If your income goes down from $100,000 to $10,000 in a year, the government does not have the right to continue to tax you on $100,000 a year simply because they have become accustomed to the manner in which you are keeping them. That's not fair. And I would also ask you to ask yourself, what is unfair about allowing a payer to retire without having to go through costly and nasty litigation? I would ask yourself, what is unfair about limiting the time that one person must support another person post-divorce? We should encourage independence, and again, I apologize, but it is true. Women are the majority of recipients of alimony, and as a woman who I put myself through college and law school, and I have worked since I was 14 years old, and my husband's ex-wife attorney during her discovery process referred to me as expensive to maintain. I'm not expensive to maintain. I'm an independent, intelligent woman, and I believe that many recipients are also independent and intelligent women who simply are locked into almost a welfare-type situation where it's easier to sit at home and collect a check than it is to get out there and become a contributing member of society. I'm just going to, I know we're done, so I'm going to close with just a horror story that we could all just imagine if this were true. It kind of touches on a point I made a couple of minutes ago. Imagine that you all decide to go off and do something else and not be in the legislature anymore, and you all get great jobs, and you make $200,000 a year. That would be wonderful, wouldn't it? And then you lose your jobs. and you get a letter from the IRS that says, we really, really appreciate so much that you were earning $200,000 a year. We really enjoyed taxing you at, you know, close to 40%. Yeah, we got your return. We understand that you're making $20,000 a year now. But we really liked it when you made $200,000 a year. We really liked taxing you on 40% of $200,000 a year. So we're going to keep doing that. And if you can't pay it, you're going to go to jail. Because that, in reality, is what a lot of alimony payers face in this state and around the country. And we have a movement, a national movement that's happening. It's gaining ground, and Oregon is getting on the bus of alimony reform. And I thank you all so much for letting me speak.
Thank you, Robin. I apologize we had to cut you short. All right, our next panel.
Judge McKnight.
Good morning, Chair Prezanski, co-chairs Krieger and Barker. Good morning to you. I'm Judge Maureen McKnight. I'm the Chief Family Court Judge in Multnomah County. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip the 9 slides I had prepared, and I'm going to just try to concentrate on a few points if I can.
You can, and you can go ahead and put your presentation. We have other people that will be able to be here, but I know that for myself, I have to be at another committee to chair, and so you'll see some of us leave. It's not because we don't want to be here. We just can't be in two places.
I think I can cover orally, and I know the PowerPoint is available in hard copy to you. I just wanted to highlight a few of the basics, particularly against the backdrop of the suggestions from the proponents. I want to highlight, first of all, that the standard that judges need to follow in terms of setting spousal support is one of whether the award is just and equitable. So whether we award support, and if so, how much and how long, is totally addressed by the issue of just and equitable. And unlike child support, where there's a categorical obligation to pay child support, and very few individuals, perhaps if you're incarcerated and don't have the income, but every parent needs to be does have a duty to pay child support. Not every ex-spouse is obligated to pay support for that spouse. So it's a much more fact-driven kind of analysis. Oregon law recognizes, in fact, that we have different purposes for spousal support awards. It's not all necessarily akin to child support in terms of meeting basic needs. We have transitional support, which was alluded to by the prior speaker. These are funds usually for a limited duration that have to do with helping a spouse re-enter the job market or advance in that job market. We have compensatory spousal support. This is really reimbursement for what has been a significant contribution in the past to the marriage, and for which the spouse with the greater earning capacity will likely continue to benefit when the marriage is over. Usually this is a contribution to perhaps helping someone put them through school or providing homemaker services while someone advanced in the career. So that compensatory function is different than the transitional re-enter the job market. And then we have maintenance support, and this can be ordered for a finite period or indefinitely. And again, that's to help. It's a contribution a spouse makes, usually in a longer-term marriage, to help maintain the standard of living during the marriage. As a judge, I can order 1, 2, or 3 types of support. I can order them concurrently or consecutively. I can order one support for a certain amount and then step it down to create sort of a glide path to self-sufficiency. But all of those are individual decisions that are driven by the factors in the case. And on the PowerPoint that you don't have in front of you but is available in hard copy are the list of the factors that the statute requires me to consider in each type. It does vary by each type of support, the required factors I have to consider, and that's because, again, the purposes of spousal support are different within each category. And because they are different, I'm required in my general judgment in the time I decide whether to order spousal support to make particular findings. I have to label the type of spousal support it is to show what its purpose is, and I have to identify the factors, make findings about what were the issues that went into it. Oregon doesn't allow token awards of support. Support has to be, spousal support has to be based on the facts at the time of the judgment. So I can't enter a placeholder in the hopes that this obligor who might be in a slump right now is going to have more or higher income in the future. If parties agree on what they want, then I'm bound to honor that agreement, even if they're agreeing that it not be modifiable or that it be modifiable under certain circumstances. We actually have far more requests for modifications than we do, or hearings about modifications, frankly, and requests for mods than we do at that general judgment. I think most of the discussion in terms of court time really involves around issues of remarriage and retirement. And I know, as the prior speaker indicated, that we have a pretty strong case law in Oregon that, again, because spousal support is so fact-specific and dependent on what the original purpose was. Was it to reenter the job market? Was it to reimburse? Was it to maintain a standard of living? That remarriage does not necessarily end spousal support. It could in a given case, but it is not a categorical rule that the remarriage of the payee ends support. I know I'm going just a little quickly, but I wanted to end with one thought, and that is I'm speaking here today really for the judges on the Multnomah County bench. There are 10 of us who do primarily family law and did family law prior to entry to the bench. And in speaking with them, they were, and we are, feel pretty strongly that preserving that judicial discretion is important. But we did think there is some variance in views among us on the issue of temporary support, that perhaps a presumptive touchstone of some type, a ballpark, does have a greater utility than it does at final support. Because when we're dealing with temporary support, what we're really trying to do is to stabilize the parties financially while they work out a solution to the support. And in that context, some of the judges did believe that, because they're not looking at all the various purposes of support, in that context, the kind of cap or ballpark would be a helpful mechanism in terms of getting the parties to a stage on which they could then deal with the longer-term solutions. So I've gone somewhat quickly, but I'm mindful of the time that other speakers need. So,
does that mean our time's up?
I'll end again with the invitation and let the other speakers speak, hoping if you have questions, I'll come later.
Hey, thank you, Judge Reinheimer.
Members of the committee, my name is Gilbert Feibelman. I'm an attorney who's been in practice for 36 years. I specialize in family law. I'm the past president of the Oregon chapter of the American Academy of Matrimonial Lawyers. I'm also the past chair of the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section. In addition, in 2005, actually I think it was 2003 or 5, the legislature was taking up the issue of spousal support reinstatement, and they asked the Oregon State Bar to form a task force to study the issue and report back to the legislature with recommended statutes, and I was requested to chair that committee that actually studied the issue of reinstatement. And part of my written materials, and also attached to Mr. Carty's written materials, are the reports and information that we culled in presenting the recommendations in 2005. I think it's particularly important for this committee to understand that much of what the proponents have talked about were actually analyzed in detail in 2005. We spent 7 months researching the entire country, all 50 states, and looking at what their issues were and how they dealt with issues of spousal support reinstatement. And to a large extent, the issues that are being raised all encompass the same kind of issues of reinstatement, because they deal with why is support granted, how does remarriage factor in, how does cohabitation factor in, why is support granted in the first place, and how does different states look at it. Oregon is, what I always tell my clients, a do-what's-fair state. In terms of property division, the statute says we're supposed to divide the property as is just and proper under all the circumstances. In many ways, our spousal support statute is exactly the same. It's a do-what's-fair spousal support statute. It was totally overhauled in 1989 when we created the three kinds of spousal support that Judge McKnight just talked about. That statute now requires, and for the last 12 years has required, that the court is required to make findings what kind of spousal support you're going to grant, why you're granting it, and their statutory criteria for each kind of spouse support that the court has to address. And part of the reason for that is so that if something changes, such as you lose your job, the economy gets bad, you remarry or whatever, the court can look back and say, why was it awarded in the first place? What's changed? Have those needs been met? Is it still appropriate? In terms of, I don't want to repeat everything that we did in 2005 because you have that written material in front of you, so I just want to highlight just a few things, a few comments that come to mind to me based on the testimony. In 1976, when I graduated from law school and began practice in Salem, and I started doing some divorce cases, I started practicing with the idea of how my mother raised me, because she was a strong woman, went back to school when I was in high school and got a job, which was all women are equal to men. We're all the same. I was part of that generation. We were called the women's lib generation. Everybody was equal. Everybody could earn the same. And then I started practicing family law, and I found out the women coming into my office weren't the same. Despite women's lib, young women were still giving up career opportunities to raise a family and stay home. In fact, the 1970s weren't that much different than the 50s, other than women could get more jobs. But the reality is, in marriage, people started doing some of the same things they did before. Now, 36 years later, I've probably done 1,500 spousal support cases. I've represented men, I've represented women. I've represented women who have to pay spousal support. I've represented men who have to pay spousal support, and I've represented lots of people in modifications. I've even sat as a pro tem judge where I've had to deal with these issues. And what I found is that it's an economic fantasy to believe that there's gender equality when it comes to economics. The reality is, in most cases, it is the wife who stays home. It's the wife who works part-time so that the husband can pursue his career. Now, there's no arbitrary, everything's the same, but the problem with this is that arbitrary rules, bright lines, don't work. They don't work, particularly in family law. A rule that says you automatically end spousal support if you remarry, you automatically end it, basically negates any analysis of what the facts and circumstances are. Every case is individual. Anecdotally, I would just tell you that in my experience, you know, there's lots of cases where courts don't award spousal support. In most cases, it is half the length of the marriage. Indefinite support is only indefinite. You know, when we used to call it permanent support, but it was never permanent because the court could always terminate it, so they changed it to indefinite. But you usually have to be married 25 years or more before there's an indefinite support award. Sometimes 20 to 25 years. If it's less than that, it's very, very rare. As the judge says, it's mostly we're litigating spousal support at the modification stage. Judicial, in my opinion, judicial discretion needs to be preserved in all spousal support cases. Limiting spousal support to half the length of the marriage, not to exceed 10 years, will simply punish the spouse who took on the role of homemaker in good faith. I'll give you one brief example of a case I have that's always troubled me, even though I got her a very good award. The husband made $40,000 a month as a doctor. The wife made $1,800 a month as a part-time school music teacher. After over 30 years of marriage, four or five moves to promote the husband's career all across the country, and after four children, the husband left his wife for a younger woman who was a lawyer, not this lawyer. And basically, she got a good spousal support award. Now, the question happens, I would ask you, is if she remarries some guy after all those sacrifices, and a year later she finds out he's an alcoholic who beats her, does her spousal support end? Well, it might end on remarriage, but can she get it reinstated? Under our current law, she could seek reinstatement. But the problem is, under this law, you could never seek reinstatement. Under our modification we did in 2005, we actually said if you've been married 10 years, remarried for 10 years, then there's an end to reinstatement. So we did say, because the reality is, you can't seek spousal support from a new spouse and get it if you've only been married 6 months or a year or 2 years. It just isn't going to happen. And so, factually, every case is going to be unique. In terms of this question of looking at new spouses' income. Well, first of all, in the actual divorce, there is no new spouse, so you'd never be looking at the new spouse's income. And in the divorce, you're not going to be looking at whoever they're living with at the time of divorce. It becomes relevant in a modification proceeding only to the extent that it basically subsidizes that person's living. This idea that you'd never be able to get this financial information if this law was passed, well, that's simply not true. Under the current child support guidelines, they don't want to change. Every time there's a child support modification, you get to look at the new spouse's income. It's in the statute. It's a rebuttal criteria. And it's the definition is to the extent that that person subsidizes or helps pay the expenses of the household, the court can look at it. So even under a child support law, you can look at it. It's but you don't have to include it. I would quickly wrap up with a few things. I do think that there are some things where some tweaks could be appropriate. I don't think any arbitrary bright lines of arbitrary terminations, automatic this, automatic that. However, exchanging tax information, if you have to pay spousal support or you're getting it, why shouldn't you be able to know what's changed on the other side? Making compensatory support modifiable, right now it's virtually impossible to modify, I agree with that too. And perhaps creating some rebuttable presumptions. So there's still judicial discretion, but we shift the burden of proof. So, for example, maybe there's a rebuttable presumption that the income and assets of a new spouse do not subsidize the expenses of the obligor. So the burden's on the recipient to prove it's appropriate. And the reason I bring that up is because I have had cases where the husband marries a wife who makes a lot of money, so he decides, I'm going to quit working. Bye-bye spouse support, I want to modify. I don't work anymore, so I don't have to pay. But he's only quit his job because of that. I've had the other side where the recipient quits her job because she's got a husband who makes a lot of money, and I've successfully convinced courts that she should be presumed to be able to earn the income she was making before she quit, but we have to look at these facts. Maybe a rebuttable presumption that when you've reached full Social Security age, such as age 66 or 67, retirement is in good faith, and the burden of proof is on the other person to prove that you don't have so much income in addition you can pay. Maybe a rebuttable presumption that if the spouse has been remarried for 10 years, that the purposes of support have been made. Those are all reasonable ways to address these issues where we still preserve judicial discretion, but at the same time, we look at things on a case-by-case basis. So I conclude by saying that well, let me add one more point, just one more rebuttal point to what the things. The proponent said that you don't have child support litigation ever. That's simply not true. We actually have child support litigation over what people's real income is. We have child support litigation about new spouses and their income because the guidelines deal with that. The proponent says, well, we should be able to reset things without litigation. How would that happen? Even in child support isn't reset without litigation. Child support has to be looked at under the new circumstances. And so I conclude by saying that we have already reformed child support or spouse support substantially in 1989. We took a big look at these issues in 2005 and made substantial changes to the statute. It is critical to preserve judicial discretion. It is critical to not have any arbitrary bright lines. Every case in Oregon is unique, and the judges do a good job of trying to deal with that. And as long as we have a tight budget, we're going to have a difficult time in having a lot of quick hearings and modification. Thank you.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Carty. I am an attorney in private practice here in Salem. My practice is solely devoted to family law. I am also the legislative liaison for the Oregon State Bar Family Law Section, and I chair the Family Law Section's legislative subcommittee, and it is in my official capacity with the Oregon State Bar that I appear before you today. I've provided some written materials, and I hope you'll have the chance to review those, as well as the attached written materials from the 2005-2006 Task Force on Reinstatement. Many of those factors, particularly the public policy considerations that the task force looked at in 2005 and 2006, hold true today in terms of what types of factors are important in not only awarding spousal support at the outset of a case, but in determining whether termination is appropriate, whether reinstatement is appropriate, or whether a modification is appropriate. Instead of going through those materials, let me just briefly respond to some of the points that were made by the proposals. And the Oregon State Bar is happy to look at these and consider new alternatives. As Mr. Feibelman just indicated, there are some perhaps good approaches to look at this. But the proposals we've seen from the OAR are arbitrary, bright line, must-end proposals that the court would be bound to, such as cannot look at the income of the new spouse of the payor. And let me tell you why that's not necessarily appropriate. And I'll just give you an example of a very typical case where the payor spouse shows a budget to the court saying, this is how much money I spend each month, and this budget should determine how much support I'm able to pay. And it's not uncommon for a payor spouse to inflate that budget by saying, I, the payor spouse who's now remarried, I pay all the mortgage, I pay all the car payments, I pay all the taxes, I pay for all the food, and I pay for everything that our house takes in. Meanwhile, my new spouse, who makes $80,000 a year, does not contribute anything to our household. But let's look at my budget alone, because I pay for those things, and I can show you my checkbook, where literally I write those checks. And if the court is bound to say, I cannot look at the income of the new spouse, then those checks that show that the payor spouse does pay those bills, and those bills encompass 100% of the payor spouse's income, would be tantamount to an automatic termination, because there's no available means to pay support. And the court does look at fairness. And that fairness can often be broken down in terms of when practitioners are speaking to their clients, in terms of ability of a person to pay and need of the recipient. Are there funds available? And does this person need the help? In that situation, there wouldn't be. The proponents in the testimony you just heard indicated that there is this idea that the new spouse should not be pulled into the nastiness of divorce. And to that I say, then why is it fair for the new spouse of the recipient of support to be pulled in? Because essentially that's what they're saying. They're saying if you receive support and you remarry, well, the fact that you remarried has an impact on your support. But if I remarry and I'm paying you support, the fact that I remarry shouldn't have any impact whatsoever. And that's simply not fair. And that's simply not fair. And our courts look at fairness, and as practitioners, we are interested in establishing as many guidelines as we can and establishing as much consistency as we can, but in the aspect of fairness. And what the court does is the court looks at all the circumstances of each individual case, which are unique. Each one of you are unique, each one of your families are unique, and each one of our cases is unique. And what the family law section of the Oregon State Bar is asking is for the legislature to continue to empower courts with the ability to address these unique cases uniquely, not to bind their hands by these arbitrary rules that are set up by a few unfortunate horror stories that may have happened for any number of reasons. We certainly can't look here and look down at these one, two, or three cases and say you had an unfortunate result. So the thousands of spousal support cases that judges deal with every year in Oregon should now follow the results in these three cases. And on that last topic, and I will say this, the reality is that many cases in Oregon, the vast majority, I think the last numbers were in the 85% range, are cases in which no lawyers participate. And judges are left alone to look at the facts of the case and decide whether support's appropriate. And so please, please, please enable those judges to have discretion. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Hicks.
This might be a 60-second. Could any member of our panel explain how or why child support got carved out over time?
Co-Chair Barker and Vice Chair Cruz and Co-Chair Hicks, I think I can take a stab at that. Okay. Child support is singled out basically because of federal law. Mm-hmm. Back in the 70s, the child support program began as a part of the anti-poverty program to have states capture child support from absent parents so that the federal and state payments for welfare were reduced. It was a welfare reimbursement program, and it has since transitioned into a broader view in terms of not just welfare cases, but to help people avoid needing to get other assistance. And there has been state law since, federal law since the late 80s requiring each state to have a child support guideline.
Okay.
And that doesn't exist for spousal support. And as I say, in a way, it contrasts between the unilateral categorical obligation to pay child support for need versus other purposes, not just need, for which spousal support in our state can be ordered.
And great. Representative
Hussain. Well, that answered. Thank you. But I'm happy to meet about it. I don't want to belabor the hearing any longer. Thank you, though, for your willingness to address the question.
Go ahead with your one.
Well, okay.
I was just going to add that I can tell you, though, that when I represent the people paying child support,
mm-hmm.
they feel that the arbitrary guidelines are arbitrary and it sets child support too high, mm-hmm. and they hate the fact that the judge doesn't have discretion, even on child support. So my clients are just unhappy that there's guidelines because it sets it too high. The child support guidelines were set in place because the federal government felt child support was too low, never because it was too much.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, any other questions? I just want to thank people who are involved in your line of work. It's very important to everybody. And oftentimes you think of criminal law or different civil law, but the family law practice is, really important. I appreciate the work that you guys do.
Thank you. Thank you.
We appreciate the invitation. Thank you.
And I'm going to need to adjourn now because we do have other obligations. And so I'm going to close the Interim Judiciary Committee for the House and the Senate.
Good job.
Thank you.